You said we would use the plague only as a deterrent.
To hold governments to ransom.
You promised us
we've
power.
We've served you faithfully.
Silence!
The girl that you love is mine already, and through her you will yet do my bidding.
This is Bristol. It's Friday. It's 5 o'clock. Welcome to Not the BCFM Politics Show on the 8th of December 2023. Streaming live from the PRSC Arts Centre in Bristol on the talkradio.org.uk stream and at radioqUK.com in Camberley, Surrey. Also live on the Not the BCFM Politics Show app, available free from all good app stores. That's our attempt, folks, to do marketing. People ever see that app and think, oh, what on earth is that? Just run into it. I mean, we don't do any marketing, as you might know, so please do share the show. If you're on the newsletter, please just share it around so people know we're there, and try and give us a bit of a plug if you possibly can. So that is, by the way, is available from all good app stores. The one that you can use to put on your phone, which is not Google Play, but which has got all the stuff that Google Play is supposed to have, is called the Aurora Store, which is what I have on my phone. Having said that, now it'll probably delete itself. Anyway, I'm Tony Gosling. Thank you for turning off the psycho in the corner, gaslighting us with its military grade propaganda, particularly on talk radio. I've been listening to today, and puff pieces on the conspirators and hatchet jobs on the heroes. The McCarthyite witch hunt's going on after anyone with influence who speaks up for humanity on a national level, and also against the World War III wage slavery lies, which is where they're all trying to send us all, it seems. This accelerationist strategy, for those with eyes to see and ears to hear, so-called solutions to every crisis, Ukraine, Gaza, climate, migrant, COVID, economics, accelerationists, Armageddonists like Nick Land and his Dark Enlightenment, my old school friend. Well, we'll be hearing from another old friend of mine. I thought he was my friend, is one word I like to use. Quoted from Viktor Ostrovsky, the former Mossad agent who wrote an excellent book, By Way of Deception, is also George Monbiot. We'll be hearing from him. So helping us navigate the World Economic Forum's Fourth Industrial Revolution and the Fourth Reich Matrix, it's Irish Republican Labour Party activist Martin Summers, as well as local freelance journalist Joe Banks. In part one, we'll be looking at the annual general meeting, or they call it the annual convention, of something called the Workers' Party, which is a new party. You know, it used to be Respect, I think. That's been ditched now. It's George Galloway, Chris Williamson and others, former MPs on the Labour left, putting a party together. And apparently Jeremy Corbyn doesn't want to join them, unfortunately. But anyway, they had their annual convention. We'll be hearing from them. And George's announcement last Saturday that he will be running for Mayor of London. So let's see how he gets on there. And in part two, we'll be speaking to local musician David Moat about the horrendous situation in Gaza. Now, I did switch on about 5 or 10 minutes in, but I don't think they even talked about Gaza last night on BBC Question Time, which I find that absolutely extraordinary. And it might be simply because last week's BBC Question Time was such a mess. They had a complete car crash ending right in the middle of a fascinating discussion where Fiona Bruce said, right, that's it, everybody, and switched off the cameras. And that was the end of the program. This is very, very unprofessional, folks. Anyway, Iranian and Russian news banned in the UK, first by the telecoms cartel and then by Ofcom. And us cancelled off Bristol Community FM by the Bristol Mafia, but still not cancelled here yet, thank God. So joined by Joe Banks. Joe, welcome again.
Thank you very much.
You'll be becoming a regular here, scrutinising the...
It's nice to be invited back.
Yeah, well, you know, it's always so much to talk about, the way local government works here in Bristol particularly. And the big pressures on it are mainly, it seems, through the planning system, but there are others too, aren't there?
Yeah. I mean, planning's got very controversial. It's getting, this is partly, you know, consequence of the mayoral system in Bristol. That's one of the things the mayoral systems, that's what they're sort of designed to do, is to, as the mayor often says, get things done. But also planning has become, you know, a political issue against the Greens in Bristol. It's Labour against the Greens, really, to who's going to control the council. And there's a lot of controversy over over planning committees and...
Can I just, sorry to interrupt you, Martin, planning is a biggie, isn't it? I mean, this is one of the major ways in which the people we elect are supposed to be pushing back against unbridled developers, sort of building these massive castles in the sky. And of course, they would build right in the city centre enormous great multi-storey office blocks everywhere, given half a chance, because that's the way they recoup more money.
Well, the system in Britain is pro-development. That's one of the things that makes us special in the world, because we allow entrepreneurs to get ahead and do this sort of stuff, and there isn't, in fact, a great deal to stop them, and there never has been.
And it's for private profit, a lot of it. It's not for the benefit of Bristol itself. This is just somebody saying, well, actually, I think if we build this here, it'll make us a lot of money.
That's right. And, of course, in the 1940s, the local authorities had quite significant planning powers. So, you know, they knocked down slum areas, they built council houses in huge estates, and, you know, there was quite a strong, you know, that basically the councils decided what was going to go where what. But that was all got rid of. And we went back to the previous system, which was basically run by those with an eye to making private profit. And that, of course, is exactly what Thatcherism was all about. And, of course, it wasn't actually about people building new businesses. It's about exploiting the margins on real estate.
Well, one of the it's not just giving planning permission for things that the city council, and I'm not sure which you'd like to start with, but I think maybe because we had George Ferguson, the former mayor, on a couple of weeks ago, talking about the massive overspend at what they call the Beacon Centre. Oh, is it the Bristol Beacon?
Bristol Beacon. Yeah.
So
which was the Colston Hall?
It was the Colston Hall. So they decided we're going to have a name change because Edward Colston was thrown into the river, and we don't like him anymore. Well, we never did like him actually, but it's quite good to see him go, and to be put into a museum lying on his side with a load of dents in. But so we've now got this thing called the Bristol Beacon. Just chatting to you before we sat down, I can remember going in there on the grand opening. It would be about, I think, 2008, 2009, where there'd been a massive amount of work done on the Bristol Beacon, mostly Arts Council funded, and as it then was the Colston Hall, with a massive new foyer, several floors, new bars and things. And just looking at the video of this, as it was last weekend, it's this week it was opened officially, and it started to do business in there, business being the operative word. It's quite expensive getting in if you want to get tickets to do this and that. So it's not really being run for, say, for example, your local amateur dramatic societies and that kind of thing. But, of course, there will be a good programme on over Christmas. That's why they've opened it now. Can you just give us a run-through of the figures? Because initially the council promised that they were going to set aside £10 million. We've got something like £350 million annual budget. So quite a slice of that for this regeneration. The government were going to make up quite a considerable amount more.
It was going to be... so it was originally, the budget was £48.8 million. That was established in around 2017. As you say, Bristol City Council were going to put in £10 million. There was funding from the West of England Combined Authority. I think the Arts Council was going to make up the rest. And that was already going to be the largest capital redevelopment ever to take place in the southwest arts sector, just to give it some context.
Fair to say ever, is it? Because it does go up with inflation, but in terms of the amount of money actually spent, this is the biggest so far ever.
Yeah.
I said it there as well. Yeah.
Yeah. It was originally at that original price, and what happened? I mean, essentially, what happened? Was that they didn't do any surveying work. This is a very old building. You know, there was a medieval friary on this site. And then there was a sort of Elizabethan hall there. Anyone with a passing knowledge of that bit of Bristol, you know, knew that that was a very, very old site, old building. But they didn't do any surveying work. And they basically went in there, signed off the contracts with the contractor Wilmot Dixon, and then discovered that there were all these hidden, you know, nightmares as they peeled back the building, and it went into COVID period, where there were, you know, supply issues and labour problems with labour costs and all this, which added to it.
Okay, sorry.
So that's the sort of that's the official line that we're given, and we're meant to accept. You know, this was just, you know, events couldn't be helped, and so in 2021 you had a revised budget. It jumped to 106.9 million, so more than doubled. And then in January 2023, the figure had jumped again to 131.9 million. So we've gone from 48.8 to 131.9. And the contribution from the council, who in this arrangement were liable for any increase, any issue they found, all the risk was on the council. Bristol City Council has ended up paying 84 million from an original 10 million. Yeah, and and just reading, I mean, there have been stories, as you said, the Beacon opened this weekend. There have been stories in the Bristol local media about this. You know, you've had articles from the local Democracy Reporter in the Bristol Post. You've had the Bristol Cable write something about it, but none of it really gives you. You're basically getting a regurgitation of the official version of events. You're not getting any real context.
Context is so important with these things. Individuals, specific individuals.
And relationships of people.
Yeah, which companies have they worked for in the past?
Yes.
Who are their best friends? Who are their chums from old companies?
Yeah.
Martin, this sort of thing with, I mean, we're hearing there about eight times the amount of money that Bristol City Council was supposed to pay got paid to build this thing. The same sort of thing, these massive cost overruns, has gone on with things like HS2, Hinkley, and actually it's systematic, isn't it, in big defence contracts too?
Well, in defence contracts, it's cost plus. And you've only got often one company that's going to get the work because they're the only ones who can do it. So that is really where all the money goes. Let's not kid ourselves. We argue about this stuff about, building buildings in Bristol, but the defence industry is where all the real kickbacks get done. And it's the most expensive stuff as well. But anyway, but we're focusing here on this particular thing in Bristol. And, we had George Ferguson in the other week, as you know, who used to be the mayor, and he's a former architect, and he was just saying that's exactly what he was saying, is that the council basically been totally naive here. They should never have signed this contract where they end up picking up the tab for everything that goes wrong.
Well,
they should
have split naive?
That with whoever was doing the contract, but they didn't do it.
Is it naive, or is it people who are mates, who are working together?
What I'd suggest is you're dealing with a bit of psychology here, maybe, in that if you put a mayor in charge of everything and he's actually not all that well-versed with things like these sort of contracts, for example, as George Ferguson was.
Yeah, Ferguson would understand
such contracts. Now you've got a mayor and they're saying, well, can you sign this, please? Yeah, and sign on the dotted line. He's not actually able to say, well, hang on a minute, what if this bit goes wrong? Is there penalty clauses for the contractors?
Yeah. Because he's not the mayor isn't doing. He's given this to a guy called Colin Moulton, who was the executive director of Growth and Regeneration.
Yeah,
he was overseeing the contract in 2018, and this is where I think you've got to look back to understand this. Is look back to what was going on in Bristol Council in 2017 and 2018. So Colin Moulton had come in, essentially, into the council in October 2017 from Homes England, or as it was then, the Homes and Communities Agency, which was basically quite quango, spending government money, but not departmental, not a department of government, whose job it is to basically build affordable housing and be a property developer, but for the government to get projects off the ground. He'd come in 2017, essentially to get the arena deal sorted, which was this switch that was then going on between the city centre arena that Ferguson had organised, had set up, which was going to be by Temple Meads. The thing that really shifted that was in 2017 when Bristol City Council sold a big chunk of that area, not the arena area, but the area next to it, to Bristol University to build a new campus. And if you just run through the the dates of that. So that was in March 2017. The following month, in April 2017, you had the Malaysian developer YTL contacting this chap called Baramak Rory, who was Bristol City Council officer, director of place, suggesting that there could be an alternative, that they could potentially, they would be interested in having discussions about building an arena at the north of the city in Filton. They owned these aircraft hangars there. The next month, this guy leaves Bristol City Council to go and work for YTL. and then just to pull a few strands together, so he leaves in May 2017, joins YTL. Then the following month you have the Grenfell disaster. That's June the 14th, 2017. And this ties into another big story in Bristol that's happened in the last few weeks, which has been this evacuation of 400 council tenants from this 1950s tower block, Barton House. And so, again, you've got to look, I think you've got to look back to, if you're asking yourself why in 2023 400 people suddenly evacuated from their homes on a dark November night with no warning, 6 years after Grenfell, you've got to look back at this period, what was going on in Bristol City Council in 2017, 2018.
This was about a month ago. It was really controversial at the time. And the amazing thing about it was an evacuation. It wasn't an eviction. There wasn't any proper legal process by which people who lived there were actually served and could say, well, actually, no, I don't agree with this. Or there was no court. They were not given any opportunity in court. And just to bring us up to date on what's happening there, this week, Barton House tenants have been demanding that council bosses pause their rent. This is something that George Ferguson said it was absolutely extraordinary that they're still being charged rent, crazy, even though they've been evicted. Survey results are expected to show next week whether or not the tower block is safe to return to. So this is a process which could have taken place, what you're suggesting, is back in 2017. In fact, it should have taken place.
So what happened after Grenfell? You remember the shock of that event, the horror. The whole country felt, and this sudden, intense move to, intense focus on social tower blocks all over the country, particularly on the cladding, because obviously the cladding was the issue with the fire going up the building, but all aspects. And what's been uncovered is that a letter was sent from someone called Tamara Finkelstein, the Director General for the Building Safety Programme from the Department for Communities and Local Government, on September the 5th, 2017. She writes to all local authority chief executives about these large panel system buildings, which Barton House is, that's the construction. It was built in 1958. In 2017, they'd done investigations of LPS blocks in Southwark. And this letter sent to every council in the country said, it is important with all large panel systems buildings that their structural history is known and that their condition and continued structural integrity are understood and monitored. This should include desktop studies where necessary to establish what strengthening work has been undertaken and, to assess the original design of the building. This is the issue that has led to the sudden eviction of people the other week, because the council said, we've had this, they've done a survey here in 2023 that's come back and said, the building doesn't match the original plans that we have.
Well, there's two major problems here. One is that they didn't act on the original letter.
Yes, they didn't act on the letter.
Secondly, it's almost like it's an arbitrary time for them to have evacuated it. There's quite a lot of conspiracy theories, if I can call them that, and actually someone, you know, needs an explanation of what's happening, what the council are telling the residents doesn't make much sense at all to most of them. The residents themselves have said that they want a timeline from the council, or maybe they should just listen to this show to get a bit of a timeline.
Well, I've put in a Freedom of Information request about this letter to the council. I'm still waiting to hear back from them. They're still within their statutory time limit.
Well, the point is that there could be other reasons for that meeting being cancelled rather than this is the November 4 council meeting, rather than that this could possibly have been, if you're a cynical person, an excuse.
So.
Well, some people are saying, they're saying is that there was an item on the agenda at the last 4 council meeting which would have been extremely embarrassing for the Mayor Marvin Rees to have to answer, and that was to do with the wrong legal advice over complaints that have been going on in the City Council. Mm. So there were several items which are controversial. The Mayor was out of the country for the November 4 Council. He's always here for the Cabinets, but not for the 4 Council meetings. He seems to sort of schedule his trips away.
He's in Dubai at the moment.
Yeah, that's right. So this next meeting, he won't be here. I think actually this latest 4 Council meeting, he's not
but
there.
But those questions will be asked at this 4 Council meeting coming up next week. So I do think that, I do think that is a step too far to think there's a conspiracy there, because I don't think they would have just turned out 400 people at 5 o'clock
morning. It's just that the decision making process is completely failing and they're panicking. Let's get back to Barton House.
Yeah, so you had that letter coming in September, and this wasn't clearly acted on. That same day that was sent, September the 5th, 2017, the Chief of Executive of Bristol City Council, Anna Klonowski, not sure that's the right pronunciation, but she resigned. And she'd been in the role less than 7 months, but she left the job literally that same day, saying that she wanted to focus on her role as a carer for her parents. Now, I don't think the two things are linked, but you clearly had this period where there was... not only was she gone, and she wasn't replaced for another 7 months until Mike Jackson became chief executive. You can see council documents of their list of senior management from the period. 12 of the 25 senior officers in the council, 12 of those positions were vacant. So it's a period where there's clearly an element of sort of chaos in the council and lack of leadership. Step in the following month, October, this guy Colin Moulton comes from Homes England. He takes up the position of Executive Director of Growth and Regeneration. He's on a vast salary, on 256 grand a year, incidentally. He'd also been... He's one of these people who's come from the South West Regional Development Agency as well before that, like the current chief executive, Stephen Peacock, the merchant venturers, John Savage and Colin Skellett, who owns Wessex Water and runs UK YTL, relevant. So he's brought in... Essentially, at this point, that Bristol University have bought the land, want to build a campus, and there's this move now that we don't want to have an arena in the city centre. 2017, Marvin Rees has his flights and his accommodation paid for by YTL to go to Kuala Lumpur in Malaysia and meets YTL. He also, while he's there, meets the Malaysian development firm EcoWorld. Now, EcoWorld, the previous month in November, had announced a joint venture with Wilmot Dixon, the contractor of the Bristol Beacon. This was EcoWorld had taken a 70% stake in Wilmot Dixon's residential arm, because Wilmot Dixon are a developer as well as a builder, as a contractor. And at this point, stepping into the story, we have Sir Edward Lister, who was Boris Johnson's right-hand man when he was London mayor. Previous to that, he'd been the long-time chief council leader of Wandsworth Council. Famously, the sort of trailblazer for local authorities who went into privatisation and outsourcing they started doing it even before Thatcher got going. They started doing this in the late 70s.
Martin, can you say something about this? Because this Lister guy, I mean, this was controversial. Even Conservative councils at the time were saying, you can't contract out to a private company, things like the local bin collections and things like that. So this guy was what you would call as Joe has just described, a trailblazer in getting things privatised when it was way before it was in fashion in the 1980s.
Yeah, well, I was living in Fulham at the time, and that's just across the river from Wandsworth. So we were very well aware of what was going on there. And, of course, all of these things have to be, you know, trailblazed by somebody, which then, of course, when they get away with it, everybody else says, oh, it's just normal now to imagine that everything's going to be contracted out. It wasn't in those days, because there was a culture of certain things have to be run by the council, because that's the appropriate body to run.
Because then if they go bankrupt, the council will deal with it, rather than suddenly
bankrupt, because they're part of the council. They can't go bankrupt.
Well, once they've been privatised, they can go bankrupt.
Yes, and they could also fail to deliver. And people, I mean, one of the things we used to knock on doors around Bristol, you know, I was knocking on doors for the Labour Party, and people would complain about the waste collection. And the local councils would have to explain to people, well, we don't directly do that anymore. Mm. In the old days, we could have gone straight to the waste collection people and said, you know, what's happening here on this, but there's a whole set of people you have to go to. My dad used to be a head teacher. The dinner staff used to be accountable to him. But once it's privatised out, the cleaning, then people come in and say, the cleaning hasn't been done. There's nothing he can do about it. It's a contract that's been made above his head. And this, of course, this culture of subcontracting has just become the norm. It's now begun to dawn on people that it's actually stupid.
It's also parasitic, as we've seen with the what's been going on at Bristol Beacon, with Bristol Energy, these various things where, you know, the council is saying, oh, what do you mean? We have to cough up another £50 million. Oh, no, where are we going to get that from?
Yeah, well, it's the whole concept of the third sector. I used to be a social economy development worker for the council briefly. And the whole idea of the third sector was that it's not run by the government or by the local authority, and it's not private, it's something else. And, of course, what that really boiled down to, it was quite interesting, we had a Japanese delegation from Kobe in Japan coming to see what we were doing, and they asked some very pertinent questions, like, well, you know, you've given this building in Southville, the what used to be a school has become Southville Community Centre, and they said it's on a 999-year lease. I mean, what's that about? Because, of course, it's illegal to just give it to them, because it's public property. You can't just hand it over to a third sector organisation. So what they've done is they've got round this by giving out these massive long leases, which these Japanese civil servants picked up immediately. What's this about? And, of course, there is no legal basis for the third sector. This is what the legal people in the council were telling us. Look, you can't use public funds or public... you've got to sell it at what it's worth.
Well, this is why I come back to...
You can't just hand it over to... They were trying to task me to come up with a cost-benefit analysis which would show that this third sector organisation, Southfield Community Centre, whatever it was, would be of more benefit to Bristol than if the council carried on running it. And I had to tell them I can't come up with that because it's just, you know, he's just making stuff up.
It's fiction.
It's illegal in any case. So I spoke to the legal people in the council and they said, well, they can't do that. It's illegal.
Well,
there's no point.
I mean, there is a text and a sub-agenda to all of this, and that is that the more you outsource stuff, the less you have to be responsible for it, and the more you can just hold up your hands when everything collapses. And actually, what we've been seeing over the last few months is several urban city councils going bankrupt and simply not being able to afford to run these services at all. In fact, there's a whole bunch of statutory services that they have to run, so that's why they've been closing things like public toilets, because this is not a statutory thing that they have to do. So they've been paring everything down to only the things that they are forced to do by law. And even those, they're getting away with not doing, like special educational needs kids. They're not educating them properly, even though they're supposed to by law. But anyway, let's get back to the story.
So Edward Lister.
Yeah, so Edward Lister. Yeah.
So he's done his work in Wandsworth. And then he joins Boris Johnson in 2011. And becomes his steadying. He's known as Steady Eddie. He's his steadying influence. You know, you've got the chaos of Boris Johnson. He's his guy who's sorting out the deals. You know, doing the work in the background. And he is his chief of staff and deputy mayor for planning in London, 2011 to 2016. And he's one of the controversies of his time there. He's a man with all kinds of conflicts of interest. One of the things he does there, he approves a development of Barking Wharf, despite City Hall officers raising concerns that it included no affordable housing, which was in breach of the London guidelines. Payments were made by the developer in lieu of affordable housing, and this was Wilmot Dixon. Again, it was owned by Wilmot Dixon, and then it was bought by this Malaysian company, EcoWorld, in 2017. Now, Lister's relationship with EcoWorld, when Johnson stops being mayor in 2016, Lister becomes the chairman of the Homes and Communities Agency, which is now Homes England. But 2 weeks later, he takes up a directorship with EcoWorld, and the Times actually reported in 2020 that between 2016 and 2019, Lister took almost £500,000 in consultancy fees from EcoWorld.
So they were, let's just make it clear, they were consultancy fees, not bribes.
Yes, that's very clear.
I think that's what he'd say.
So can we just bring this up a bit more up to date with Lister in Bristol?
Yeah. Well, you've got Moulton there. Moulton was obviously at Homes England with Lister. He invites Marvin Rees to a dinner. The invitation goes out late January 2018, and they attend this dinner at the Mercure Brigstow on February the 21st. And at this point, the arena scheme is pretty well developed, and Marvin Rees both wants Homes England's involvement in the wider Temple Quarter project, and he wants Edward Lister's personal backing for this arena switch. So they have this dinner on February the 21st. Interestingly, I'm not saying this is directly connected, but again, it ties into this issue of relationships around this. The very day after that dinner, Wilmot Dixon announced that they're the chosen contractor for the Colston Hall refurbishment, and contract negotiations are ongoing with Colin Moulton overseeing that for Bristol City Council. If you look through, you can see through Freedom of Information requests, you can see the correspondence between Lister's assistant and Rees's assistant throughout 2018. It's quite funny actually, because Rees is desperately trying to get a breakfast or a lunch or a dinner with Lister, and they can never find a date. But eventually they do have a breakfast meeting. And after that dinner, you can see the exchanges where Lister is saying he'll do anything he can to support Rees.
I'd just like to contrast this with the whole situation with the Coomber project, with them asking to meet Marvin Rees. Marvin Rees is far too busy because he's typing emails trying to meet these top Tories, and they don't want to meet him. But he's, you know, there's a bit of an interesting contrast there.
Well, the overall picture, this can get quite complicated.
And he's a Tory. This is the key thing. This guy is a top pro-privatisation Tory strategist.
Yeah. I mean, what Rees would probably say was, you know, I've got to deal with the world as I find it, and I'm trying to get the best thing for Bristol. But he, I mean, he, yeah, he totally. But I think you can see in the move of the arena, and in the way that, you know, the establishment of Bristol can get their classical music hall for whatever it costs. But the democratic idea of having an arena for everyone, a 12,000 venue in the centre of the city, rather than, you know, where people in South Bristol, people in North Bristol can come together, come to it, rather than having this thing stuck out, you know, built by this Malaysian property developer right on the northern fringe.
It's not even in Bristol, is it? It's South Gloucester.
It's right on the border, isn't it?
Well, just on the edge. Yeah.
But to me, it shows you who's running the show, really. You know, who's running Bristol.
Who is running Bristol?
Well, it's you've got vested property interests. You've got this very well-run, you know, tightly connected network of people connected to the merchant venturers who are connected to the various quangos, you know, and you can keep. And we haven't even got into, and you have a real lack of scrutiny, both from, you know, within the council. You're supposed to have opposition councillors who are scrutinising all this stuff, and you're supposed to have a local media who are, investigating it and bring it to light. And I think Bristol is lacking, an effective ability to scrutinise, you know, in both areas.
Well, I think the media have done a reasonable job, considering the amount of information that's out there. Like you say, you have to do these freedom of information requests. So, for example, Martin, I put it to you that much of this is a bunch of people who are actually really in their heart of hearts interested in private businesses and their careers. They don't really care about, you know, whatever it is, 350,000 Bristolians that vote for them. And actually, it has ended up rather convenient for the privatisers. They're bleeding the city dry.
Well, I think there's certainly the case that people who are, this revolving door between the quangos and the private sector is extremely dubious, is it not? I think what you just said about Marvin, what he would say is he's just dealing with the world as it is rather than as he would like it to be. But that becomes an excuse for just basically letting these people do whatever they want. Mm. And actually, of course, getting your benefit from it, because you then present yourself as somebody who gets stuff done. Yeah. And you can then present yourself.
I suppose
in a recession
or a slump, one of the few places where there are big lumps of cash that unscrupulous developers or anybody can get their hands on is in local government. If you can
local
find
government
somebody,
has always been a place. Yeah. I mean, local government, because it makes the planning decisions. The developers, the property developers, the people who spend money on property, they've got a, you know, it's like criminal gangs want to corrupt the police, you know. It's an essential part of what you've got to do.
Well, so we've been looking at three main things. We've been looking at the Bristol Beacon, which is in the city centre. It's the new concert hall that's just been revamped. I don't really think it needed to be revamped, but it was for 130 odd million pounds. We've also been looking at Barton House and finally the arena and the move of the arena. All these are big projects.
Which hasn't even started building.
The arena is just talk.
They put in, you know, because what they did, YTL, is they put in a load of, you know, huge luxury development, residential development, 2,500 flats. But they needed to put in all the, you know, just if they were going to do an arena, they had to get all the transport, the infrastructure in, which is now just feeding their property development. They haven't started that.
Paid for by the council. Yes. All the infrastructure.
Also, look at the new train station.
The decision to have the university take over the Temple Meads site rather than the arena, which seems to me is all predicated around the student grants and student loans. Well, it's not grants, is it? It's loans. There's loads of money coming into the pockets of students. Plus, as you say, loads of foreign students who are paying even higher fees.
At least 25% of Bristol University students.
That's right. Students. So there is, they know that there's a load of cash coming in with regards to university students.
And, this new campus is a business. It's they call it an enterprise campus. You know, it's this is not people learning ancient Greek or whatever. The big AI supercomputer. I think that's going to be on that.
Okay. Anyway, look. So the council would have spent. It's estimated either four or five figure sum. So somewhere between 1,000 and maybe 20,000 on doing this survey at Barton House that they should have done back in 2017. It'd be interesting to talk to that chief executive that left the same day about whether that was discussed and whether she was told we're not going to do it.
What they did with this letter.
It's got lost somewhere, got put in a waste paper bin or deleted off the emails.
You know, after Grenfell, after seeing what happened.
Yeah, it's just like, we can't be bothered to do this. But they couldn't be bothered.
I think they were thinking about other things. This is what I'm saying. They were really focused.
They would have had to spend a bit of money. But now, even if next week everyone can go back to Barton House, that will still have cost Bristol £3.5 million. So rather than spending 10 grand back in 2017, Martin, we're now looking at, however many times 3.5 million is what? Is it another 100 times the cost?
I don't think they'll go back in. I don't think anyone's going to go and live in that.
No?
No, I think
what are they going to do? Redevelop it?
They'll knock it down.
Rebuild it then. Yes, of course. Yeah, this is what happened in London quite a lot. George Ferguson, the former mayor, was quite cynical about whether he thought that would ever happen. So anyway, do you want to just sum up, please, Joe, what this tells us, this sorry tale about the sort of cliquey nature and who some of these key figures are of the way that the city council is now being run?
Well, I mean, we're due a big change. Marvin Rees goes in May next year. And I hope there will be an adjustment, and what happened, you know, Bristol had this reputation where you couldn't get things done, where you couldn't get things through planning. So they've really pounced on Rees and seen in him someone who did what they wanted them to do.
Yeah, you just wanted cranes on the horizon, and that was good
because that shows energy and ambition, and there are lots of things, especially in a time of austerity, you know, where so a mayor is restricted in a huge amount of what they can do, and so you know development and regeneration become this big thing that you can show you're doing stuff, this whole development around. Where the arena was going to be, I actually haven't said what is happening there now. I mean, this was another shocking thing, was that in order to get the arena moved to Filton on the northern fringe of Bristol, they had to beat what's called a sequential test, where if you have a city centre site for some big piece of infrastructure, that's always got to take priority, because you're trying to limit people travelling. I mean, and you know, obviously this was right next to Templemere Station, the busiest transport sort of hub in the southwest. But in order to do that, they had to stitch up this deal with Legal & General, the asset manager, to work out. And this was the other thing that Colin Moulton was doing at the time. You know, they weren't thinking about the social housing stock. They were desperate to stitch up this deal so they could work out what they were going to do with the arena site. So they gave Legal & General this fantastic deal where they said Bristol City Council will spend £32 million just preparing the site for you, and then we'll guarantee rents for 40 years on one of the office blocks you want to build there. So that's the deal that's been done. And now Legal & General are going to build a conference centre, hotel, offices and some flats.
Good. Council tax payers paying there?
Yes. Yeah, and guaranteeing rents in their office block. It's crazy, but they were desperate to get the sort. They couldn't get the arena things done in Filton unless they had that deal sorted.
Sounds like the sort of deal that Gordon Brown did back in 2008, Martin, to bail out the economy. The bank's saying, look, it's all going to go crazy unless you sign this piece of paper, Gordy.
Well, I think it's more like the private finance initiative, which they did that because it doesn't, if you borrow the money from the city, it doesn't go on to public expenditure. It just it becomes, you know, it's not counted as public expense. But of course, it's much cheaper to do it yourself than borrowing the money. And this is typical of what's been going on every level. And of course, I think what George Ferguson, obviously, he pretty much critical of all of this stuff. I mean, he just didn't approve of any of it because his approach was very much rather the opposite.
I mean, I think it's also fair to say there's been a complete breakdown in relationships as well within the City Council under our marvellous Marvin the Mayor. And I see this week the Labour Party is going to boycott Bristol planning meetings in what they're calling a race and religious abuse row. So Planning Committee Chair, that's Annie Stafford Townsend, is taking legal advice on defamation after Bristol's Labour Group's decision not to attend meetings until further notice. So, I mean,
why are they saying this?
Well, this was around. So, this was a very controversial application where the council want to expand a cemetery, South Bristol Cemetery,
yeah,
on land that they had previously rented to Yew Tree Farm, which is the last working farm in Bristol.
Right.
And it got very, you know, a lot of passionate defenders of this last farm, which is being nibbled away at. There's also a developer who, yeah, wants some of the land. And it, at the end of the meeting, it got kind of very heated. And there was a Muslim lady there who had taken umbrage at the fact that a Muslim Labour councillor had brought up the issue of burials for Muslim people, and then the Labour councillor had got upset that she'd brought that in, and there was a bit of a hoo-ha over that. But you know, this is just where planning has become a bit of a football, and I think it's a way to hit the greens, and you know.
So can I just clarify this? I wouldn't have known about this unless I'd been on the show. Mm. So the Labour Party are boycotting the planning.
Well, you would. It's been in the local press.
Yes. Well, I haven't followed it. I'm sorry, Tony.
Which is, but that's. I mean, but,
I'm following Gaza and Ukraine. You know,
those meetings. Those main meetings will still be quorate. That's what it, yeah, says, isn't it? Quorate. So they can still go ahead even if Labour councillors aren't there. Yeah. So I don't really understand. I mean, they're sort of grandstanding, but
sure. Let's just read out what was said, allegedly, anyway, in the Bristol Post article. Councillor Stafford Townsend, who was chairing the meeting, came down from the chair's seat to accompany the members of the public out of the council chamber, telling them to take it outside, which doesn't necessarily sound like the right or best way to put it. See you outside,
see you,
mate. Yeah. And Ms. Dumont continued. She was one of the people who were campaigning for Yew Tree Farm not to be given to the cemetery, this section of Yew Tree Farm. Where are the people to represent us? She said, not sitting there saying that. I'm a Muslim. I'm not expecting my relative to die now and then just keep that area for them to use my religion to prove something. That is the ruin of dot, dot, dot. And that's when He was interrupted by Councillor Farah Hussein, Labour for Central in Bristol, whom the comments were directed, interrupted. She said, no, I'm not accepting that. And the argument continued as that recording ended. So there was an argument of some sort after that about this. And the fact that I can't quite see how this is worth something
they blamed it up. You know, they're just trying to make.
They're saying that this was racist because the word Muslim was used.
To attack the Green chair of the committee, really, because you know the other planning committee is chaired by the Conservative Richard Eddy, who's got into his own big controversy around the Broadwalk.
But anyway, so we're looking at lots of kind of meltdowns here, and do chip in if you've got any other bits and pieces to add. But we've got some good news.
Yeah.
I'll give you that in a minute. Yeah. First, the bad news. More bad news. Bristol Watershed Cinema chief has slammed the loss of public funding and claims the city's underinvesting culture. Well, of course, when there's no money around, this is the first thing to go. You know, all the nice things in life, like cinemas, yeah, plays, pubs.
Bad timing with the Beacon opening.
Yeah, and the blow comes in the same week that two other cinemas in Bristol are closing down. cinema chief has slammed the loss of public funding, as she claimed Bristol underinvests in the city's culture. Next April, the Watershed and the Old Vic Theatre and Exchange Music Venue will lose thousands of subsidies that they have been getting for many years from Bristol City Council. Claire Reddington, chief executive of the Watershed, said Bristol doesn't have a clear cultural strategy. And various people around the city have pointed out, this is amazing, really, Joe, that the body that decides on this funding is now anonymous.
That was mind-blowing. I'm continually shocked. You know, I always think it can't get any more ridiculous.
You would think, well, hang on, there must be a committee of councillors that goes through this and looks at the benefits of each one that members of the public can go and chat with and lobby for or whatever, and even directors of these various places can say, well, we think, you know, it's worth the 10 grand or 20 grand, whatever we get from you, for this reason. No, it's an anonymous group of people. This is the way things are. This is called the One City Plan, I believe.
Yes. So, I mean, this is entirely typical.
Designed to divide and rule.
Of the mayoral system, the system that Rees has brought in. Right. You don't need democratic scrutiny. You don't need accountability. You're just going to get voted, and you can basically do what you like. And you're going to pick the right people to do the job, and you don't need to tell the public who they are.
Yeah, well, as another journalist around the city has been doing a lot of digging into this, so I'll put a link up to that on our show page at thisweek.org.uk. But we must finish with the good news. Anyone like to guess what the good news is?
I can't imagine.
£3 million Bristol Council tax benefit cuts have been scrapped in the major U-turn where we were discussing this with Acorn and with George Ferguson and with Jeff Gollop over the last few weeks, that the council was looking to spend £6 million on trying to get £3 million from some of the poorest people in the city, where they actually reckon they might only get £500,000, but spending £6 million to get around about £500,000 back from the poorest in the city. This was a bit of a no-brainer, so they've done a U-turn on this one. That Mayor Marvin Rees's cabinet will abandon the idea after a huge campaign from Acorn. Plans to cut £3 million in council tax benefits have been scrapped. Deputy Mayor Councillor Craig Chaney, we've been seeing quite a lot of Craig Chaney, haven't we? Because Marvin's
never
been jetting around the world, of course, on his electric-powered private plane, probably. He's made the surprise announcement on Mayor Marvin Rees's blog. In fact, Marvin is not even in town to write his blog. So you can just imagine a computer sitting there for days gathering dust as the mayor is out around the world. And Craig's thinking, well, we ought to put something on here. But anyway, he says the decision meant the authority would have to find savings from elsewhere to balance the books. Well, I mean, if you sat and look at the amount of overspend that this council's been particularly under Mayor Marvin Rees, has been doing, I mean, they wouldn't have this problem with balancing the books. But I wonder, finally, from both of you, whether you think, Martin, you first, whether the council is going to be able to balance the books. This was a question we put to Jeff Gollop, and he certainly wasn't sure whether Bristol may be heading towards bankruptcy.
No, what he said was they're not going to balance the books except on paper. They've got, in theory, you see.
But that's not good enough, is it? Well, if your bank account's empty and you can't pay your staff.
No, the point is there are legal requirements on councils to balance the books. You see, national governments don't have such a requirement, but local authorities do. So they can't just, you know, borrow money and try and get by. If there are rules that prevent them from doing that, although, of course, there are ways round it. You basically make sure the expenditures...
Well, they can on capital. Yeah. You know, that's what they're going to do with the Beacon, is just borrow loads of money.
Yeah. Because it's a capital investment.
Yes,
that's right.
But they have a revenue budget with the Discovery
Services.
That's
right. Obviously, the person who knows more about this is George Ferguson, who used to run the council, so he knows more about it than I do.
As the interest rates go up, what are they going to do?
Well, that's a problem not just for councils. All sorts of businesses are going to go down the drain as we go. We're going to have a depression in the whole of Western Europe and Britain.
Yeah, but there
because
is.
They've blown up the Nord Stream 2 pipeline.
There is another way of doing things. And last Saturday, I was up in Birmingham at the Congress of something called the Workers' Party.
I'm George Galloway. I'm the leader of the Workers' Party. And this is our annual Congress in Birmingham. But much of the conversation has been about London because I declared this day that I will be running for Mayor of London. I've got the signatories. You need 10 signatories from 33 boroughs. So 330 signatories, and I've got them double, just in case there are any slip-ups. So I'm poised now to enter the race, And I'm going to give Sadiq Khan a run for his money, because there are hundreds of thousands of people in London who are deeply upset by the Labour Party's betrayal on Gaza, its betrayal of the Palestinian people, its refusal to do anything about bringing an end to this awful slaughter. And they are determined to punish Keir Starmer's Labour Party. And they need somebody to vote for. Well, in me, they will.
British politics is getting increasingly like US politics. You need a lot of money to get to these positions. And also, of course, do you really think Londoners would ever elect a Scotsman to run their city?
Yes, well, they elected Sadiq Khan. Plainly, London is a cosmopolitan city. There are very substantial numbers of Scottish people in London and Scottish people of Irish extraction, like me. There's a lot of Irish people in London. There's a lot of Muslim people in London who are enormously upset by Keir Starmer. There's a lot of Afro-Caribbean people who are mindful of the role I've played over decades in anti-colonial struggles, the struggle for freedom in South Africa and so on. And there are millions of white English working-class people who deserve a Labour Party worthy of the name, and they don't have one. Keir Starmer is nothing to do with Labour. On ULEZ, for example, if I'm the mayor, there'll be no ULEZ. This fetish about net zero is something that is deeply harmful to working-class people. Of course, climate is an issue, though it's certainly not globally warming here right now in Birmingham. It's freezing. But the method of punishing working class people for driving, for travelling to their work, travelling to such leisure as they can now afford, this has got to stop. This infatuation, this fetish about the environment, exemplified in the ULEZ issue, is something I'll be tackling if I'm elected mayor.
Will that be the very first thing that you do, George?
I would say scrapping ULEZ will be the first act as mayor that I will take. But the second act will be to make all those people who felt completely alienated over this last period. I mean, I've got to say, I think Sadiq Khan has been a disastrous mayor, quite apart from Gaza, quite apart from Palestine. He's a failed experiment, as I predicted he would be at the time. He's the worst mayor of London we've ever had, and we had Boris Johnson as the mayor of London. Khan is by far the worst. So you wouldn't have to do much to be a better mayor than him. If you look at crime, for example, crime on the underground is up 50%. The police are unsupported, or they are diverted to his politically correct causes. They're reduced to dancing in his LGBTQ plus trans parades. People are entitled to parade, but we don't want our policemen parading. We don't want our policemen twerking at the Notting Hill Carnival. We don't want a police service, we want a police force. We want our children to be able to safely go on the underground. Our children to be able to safely walk the streets of London. There's no point in bragging that the air quality in Oxford Street has improved by X percent if when you walk off Oxford Street into a side street, you take your last breaths dying from a stabbing attack in Soho. And that is the London that we've got. We've got a mayor who's more concerned with politically correct causes than with the basics of the job. And the first basic of the job is the protection of the people of London. And we don't have it.
So what about with Ken Livingstone when he stood as an outsider? That was actually, in a way, a different world, because he'd already been mayor of London when he was abolished before.
DLC, yeah.
he was abolished before. Yeah. For an outsider to come in like yourself, if you don't mind me calling you that, it's going to be far more difficult. We've got an increasingly Americanized politics in this country, and that's why so few people are bothering to vote, apart from the Brexit vote, which had a very good turnout. Voter turnouts are falling. What would you say to people that... Well, this time you've got to come and vote.
Well, there's everybody's an outsider in London, first of all. Most people in London weren't born in London. I wasn't born within the Bow Bells, that's true.
I mean, but an outsider, not in one of the main political parties, George.
Yeah, but I was the Member of Parliament for Bethnal Green and Bow. I stood for Mayor of London against Sadiq Khan. I got 144,000 votes. First and second preference votes. I'm looking for, now that there's no longer preferences, I'm looking for a big six-figure vote. And if I get it, I'll win.
So that's George Galloway there, Martin.
Well, I mean, he's going to stand, as he's made clear. I think they still have a two... You get a first and second preference vote in London elections. I'm not sure. It's interesting to know, because, of course, Priti Patel wants to change mayoral elections so that there is only a first-past-the-post vote. And that will be very significant if that's
Priti
the case.
Priti Patel?
Yes, you remember, she used to be the Home Secretary. I think that's important, because if there is a two-stage vote, as there was in Bristol and in most mayoral elections, then George Galloway would have a good chance to pick up a large vote. But if it's a first-past-the-post vote, then that will change the tactics involved quite significantly. I'm just not sure what the rules now are. And, of course, you know, we've just been talking a minute ago about how mayors are a bad idea, and here we are talking about mayors.
Well, I mean, yes, but not standing is an even worse idea.
Well, so if there is a position, then obviously people are going to contest it, yeah.
Largely, Marvin Rees here in Bristol was voted in as on the back of Jeremy Corbyn as the Labour Party, as a protest against the Tories.
Well, he was elected because he was the Labour candidate. That's the reality of it. If he hadn't been a Labour candidate, he wouldn't have won. It's quite straightforward. I mean, the brand is more important than the individual in this particular case.
The electoral system used for London mayor elections is first past the post, where voters cast their vote for
the
candidate
changed it.
Of their choice.
They've changed it.
Prior to the Elections Act 2022, elections were held using the supplementary vote system.
Right.
So the thing is, of course, there are precedents, aren't there, for London mayors managing to get in, even though they're not even being sponsored by a major political party.
Yeah, well,
as in Ken Livingstone's case.
Yes, but of course, in Ken Livingstone's case, we had the transferable vote system, so that also made it easier for him to stand against the Labour Party. Yeah. In actual fact, he beat...
Maybe that's why they changed the law, to stop anything like that happening again.
Well, the reason why Priti Patel changed the law is because they know that the Tories can never win if there's a transfer of vote. Whereas they've got a good chance of winning if there isn't. Because what will happen if Galloway...
There was a transfer vote for Boris, surely he won.
Yeah, yes, he won. And therefore the Tories think they can take London mayoral... they can win London mayor, provided that the opposition to them is split.
You just said that the Tories can't win if there's a transfer vote, and there was a transfer vote, and they did win.
Yes, in other words, in London, London is a particular case. Most of the other big cities, they can't. In London, they can, because Boris Johnson did, and therefore, by having a first-past-the-post vote, what George Galloway will do is quite likely lead to a Tory mayor of London. That's the likely outcome.
Well, in fact, as we continue this little journey to the Workers' Party gathering, I think maybe the best thing to do next is listen to George Galloway's speech, where he talks about the actual Well, this is the Workers' Party, what they stand for, and particularly about what happened with Jeremy Corbyn and him nearly becoming Prime Minister, except for being undermined by his own party. So let's have a listen to some more George Galloway, and we're going to hear a little bit from Chris Williamson, but in a minute, who also spoke at this party convention. So here he is talking about Jeremy Corbyn's near success in the 2017 general election, and the also, of course, this thing that they're part of called No to NATO.
Jeremy Corbyn came within less than 4,000 votes distributed across the marginal constituencies of being the Prime Minister of Britain. That's how close it was. That's how big the surge was, as Andy was talking about. He got that close, and now he's essentially an isolated man with no party around him, alone in the House of Commons, and oftentimes not even finding the right note, I'm sorry to say. We are, of course, ready to work with Corbyn and with any other individuals or forces for good. Our motto is Smethwick's not far away. Malcolm X walked the streets of Smethwick. He put it this way: we will ally with anyone for good and with no one for ill. That's our approach. So we are open to collaboration, cooperation, alliance with other forces. Sometimes only on one issue, or two or three issues. Rarely, unlikely, on all issues. We're ready for that. We're not sectarian. We showed in the organisation we founded, No to NATO, No to War, that you don't need to pass any kind of political blood test to work with us. If you accept that war and NATO are two sides of the same coin, then whatever else you believe in, whatever other politics you hold, we will work with you and cooperate with you. And that No to NATO, No to War, in just a year has become a mass presence online, but also on the streets. We have won the argument amongst millions of people that NATO and the imperial war machine ineluctably leads to one bloody war after another. We've won that argument. No one could credibly dispute it. What we said about Ukraine is turning out daily to be true. What they, our enemies, said about Ukraine is daily demonstrated to have been a lie. What we said about the nature of the political nationalist ideology of Zionism is being demonstrated in technicolor, blood-spattered technicolor, on everyone's screen, not their television screen, because that continues to be a daily lie. But fewer and fewer people are relying on their television screen to tell them what's actually happening. I became involved in the Palestinian cause in 1975. So a very long time ago indeed. And no one, I think I can say, no one in this country has been involved for longer or more prominently than me. I was talking with Peter from Edinburgh, Peter Gregson from Edinburgh, just a few moments ago. I twinned my city of Dundee with the Palestinian city of Nablus in 1980, 43 years ago. The mayor of Nablus, whose legs had been blown off in a Zionist terror bombing, came on his tin legs from Palestine to Dundee and gave us a Palestinian flag, which was promptly flown on the town hall and which still flies on the town hall 43 years later. Go on.
So that's George Galloway. He's speaking there, Martin, to the Workers' Party. But, I mean, his credentials are pretty good, aren't they? I mean, going back to 1975-1980 on the Palestinian issue, and they see this as one of their main planks, particularly of the Workers' Party foreign policy. Now, this, of course, is Jeremy Corbyn's natural territory, but he's not really interested in joining Galloway and Williamson's party, and that's probably partly because he didn't back either of these two in their various squabbles with the Labour Party, as he could have done.
Well, I think he's got his own.
Even though he was leader under Chris Williamson.
Yes, I know. Well, the point is that Jeremy Corbyn wants to remain a member of the Labour Party, and if he joined the Workers' Party, which of course he could, he'd be out straight away. And of course, at the moment, he's sitting as an independent. But his policy is that I want to get back into the Labour Party.
He wants to join the Labour Party, but the Labour Party don't want to join him.
Well, that's true. And at some point, he may decide, if they're not going to have him back in, that he could throw in his lot with the Workers' Party. But until you've decided that you are going to do that, if you do that, then Keir Starmer's got what he wants. Jeremy Corbyn's gone away, and he doesn't have to worry about him anymore. At the moment, Jeremy Corbyn's saying, well, I'm not going away. I still want to be a member of the Labour Party, and they're saying, well, we don't want you, so I'm not going away. Can you see that's where he's at? So if he was to say, I'm going to join the Workers' Party, he'd have to give up on that. So he's not giving up on that.
Keir Starmer gave his big speech at Chatham House a couple of weeks ago, in which he said, this is the now Labour leader, has taken over from Jeremy Corbyn and turned it into very much a pro-Israeli party rather than Jeremy Corbyn's pro-Palestinian party. This seems to define almost everything these days, and he's refusing to back the calls for a ceasefire. And although there's quite a lot of his MPs that would like him to do that, he's still refusing. So he was asked at this Chatham House conference whether it was right for British politicians to be calling a ceasefire and to calling out the Israeli government. And someone's rather cleverly put this little compilation together where here is Starmer asking the question with regard to Israel, and then he answers from a few weeks ago another question which was asked him about Ukraine. So check the contrast here. Anyone would say the guy was talking out of two sides of his head at the same time.
Do you think it's acting within international law?
I think it's unwise for politicians to stand on stages like this or to sit in television studios and pronounce day by day which acts may or may not be in accordance with international law. I think it's not the role of politicians.
Is Vladimir Putin a war criminal?
Yes.
Yes.
What I've seen already amounts to war crimes, particularly the awful attacks on civilians. And I think it's very important that he's held to account and is responsible. And all those that are acting with him know that they too will be held to account. And this is something which we need to make clear now, so that those who are involved at the moment know what the consequences are.
So, Martin, no calling to account of Netanyahu, but Putin has to be called to account.
Well, the contradictions are obvious, aren't they? I mean, even if it was the case...
It's Orwellian, actually, isn't it? We're supposed to think one thing one minute and another thing the next. And it's almost as if he hasn't noticed that he's totally contradicted himself and there's no kind of consistency to what he's saying.
Well, the thing is, that, as you know, we know that the hypocrisy is second nature to people in his position. He's not even...
Well, hang on, Jeremy Corbyn was in his position, but he was a man of principle.
Well, indeed, and that's why he's no longer in any position at all, because that's not how you get to power in a country that's rigged in the way that it is.
Well, this week there was some people were on a train to Edinburgh and discovered Keir Starmer sitting there with some of his aides on the train, so they decided to approach him.
Keir, how many more children in Palestine have to die before you call for a ceasefire? Over 7,000 children have died over 7,000 children have been slaughtered by Israel. This is unacceptable. What happened to human rights? What happened to democracy? We call for peace, we call for democracy. We don't see any of that when it comes to the Palestinians. 7,000 children, how many more have to die? 20,000 people, how many more people have to die? This is unacceptable. Where is your humanity?
Sir,
where is your humanity? Please don't touch me. Please do not touch me. I'm not doing anything wrong. Okay, I'm not doing anything wrong. This is I've paid for a ticket. I'm on the train.
Transport, please.
Well, just one bit of word of advice for anyone considering doing that on their phone or whatever. Give the person a good chance to answer. Let the silence speak for itself. As he didn't really even give Starmer a chance to answer, hardly. But anyway, he didn't want to answer. He's obviously under advice. In situations like this, keep stum.
Well, yes. I mean, obviously, that's what they have to do if they're buttonholed like that. But I'm afraid if you're going to be a public figure as he is, then people are going to come up to you and ask you a few questions, aren't they?
I thought he was rather polite, actually. Anyway, finally from George Galloway, he had quite a lot to say about the tactics that the Workers' Party intends to use in the next general election, which sound to me, I'm happy to hear, rather similar to the terrier-like tactics of the Brexit Party with regard to the Tories and UKIP before them.
The Workers' Party will field up to 50 parliamentary candidates in the general election of 2024. As I say, we're ready to discuss with others. If they have a better chance than us, okay. But in up to 50 constituencies, we can make the difference. Now, victory can be defined many ways. Maybe we will win those constituencies. That would be the best victory of all. But it's equally a victory if we punish the criminals that made this slaughter possible by making them lose. Making them lose is a victory for us and for the people suffering in Gaza, in Jerusalem, in the West Bank, in Lebanon, in Syria, today. And so we're going to try and do it. And I'll tell you this, they're extremely worried about the impact we can make. There are constituencies in Britain represented by supporters of Keir Starmer's line, which I remind you, he very helpfully put it in words and writing himself. I support Zionism unequivocally, he said. I unequivocally support Israel. Our answer is, okay, we'll make sure that those who disagree with you have an opportunity to vote for an alternative. And that alternative is us, the Workers' Party of Britain. You all know the constituencies I'm talking about. Now, we don't have ready-made candidates for all of these constituencies. And so I say this now. If you're watching this and you want to stand for Parliament as one of our candidates, come forward now. Come forward. We'll interview you. We'll vet you. And if you're the best man or woman for the job, we'll support you with everything that we can do. Come forward, step up. Step up to the mark. And let's have justice for the Palestinian people. And there are many, many, many people in the country who are ready to respond to such an approach. In London, do you know how many people there are in London who care about Gaza? Muslim people, Afro-Caribbean people, Generation Z people, student people, working class people of all kinds and races who care about Gaza. It's millions. There's a million Muslims alone in London. It's millions. If we could get a fraction of those millions to support me for mayor of London, Sadiq Khan is out. Out. With capital letters. Out.
So, yes, so and he's going to win. That's what he thinks, anyway. So what do you make of this bid, Martin? The Workers' Party, it's not massive. But the thing is, Galloway is extremely well-known, and this is one of the main things that counts in an election like the London Mayor.
Well, he's also won several by-elections in Bethnal Green and in Bradford. I used to know him when he was represented for Kelvin Grove in Glasgow. He's got a lot of, residual support for him personally. And the Workers' Party, I think, if they stand 50 candidates in selected seats, they may not win, but especially if they're safe Labour seats where there's no real danger of a Tory being elected, they've got a good chance of taking a substantial chunk of those
votes.
Well,
what they want to do is they want to stand in the marginal seats where this will hurt Labour. They'll lose the seat.
Well, what may then happen, of course, is we get a Tory MP elected in those seats, and, of course, the Labour Party traditionalists will say that's what you get if you do that. And, of course, Galloway has always been in favour of first-past-the-post.
Okay, so the idea is...
Although the Workers' Party are not in favour of first-past-the-post, I understand. Their position is in favour of PR.
I mean, it's quite interesting because the Brexit Party and UKIP just ignored Labour and they just went for the Tories. And in fact, what they did get out of it was a complete change in policy in the Cameron government. And Cameron didn't want to have a referendum. They forced him to.
Well, the reason why they were able to make progress was because they basically won their seats under proportional representation to the European Parliament, where hardly anybody voted. And that's where they got a lot of their initial momentum from.
It's just a
from.
Talking shop. And
I know, but it's a talking shop and they didn't even bother to go. But they, because it was a PR election, that's how Farage got elected, re-elected many times to the European Parliament. He never won a seat under first-past-the-post in Britain. Because he never had enough support in any single constituency.
You just ignored what I said.
No, I'm just saying
you did. You did completely ignore what I said.
I know. I'm just coming to
the
second point.
They were making inroads into Tory policy by standing against them and causing them a load of hassle.
No, but what they did at the last election, Tony, is
pro-EU policy.
What they did at the last election, Tony, is Farage stood them down. If he'd stood his candidates across the country as he said he was going to, and they stood a lot more than 50 candidates, we had several on in the studio.
You know why? Because they adopted the Brexit Party's policy.
And what happened?
And once they adopted the Brexit Party's policy, so then they stood them down. You seem to be completely refusing to understand that Galloway could do exactly the same sort of thing with the Labour Party.
They've got a legitimate row to hoe, and of course, if they're only going for 50 seats, so because if the Brexit Party were going to stand in all of the seats. Yeah, and also, of course, the other thing was that as I say, if they had stood, I wish they had, because as we heard earlier, Jeremy Corbyn only lost by 4,000 votes. And if the Brexit Party had taken 4,000 votes in that one constituency or across the country, he would have won.
In other words, under first past the post, everybody in Northern Ireland knows, Tony, you can't split the vote, otherwise you lose. And Peter Mandelson had not undermined him, he would have won.
Well, that's right. But that's the problem you've got to face, isn't it? Under first past the post, if you stand in a first past the post election, you can actually sabotage your own side. And of course, in Northern Ireland, nobody does that. Bobby Sands was elected because the SDLP stood down to make sure he would get enough votes to beat Ken McGuinness, who was the only loyalist candidate.
They should just leave it to Starmer and the right-wing Labour Party to get
no,
Starmer. I know you are a Labour Party member.
No, Starmer and the right-wing Labour Party, they've got to face up to the fact that if they drift to the right, as they have, they've gone out of their way to drive the left out of the Labour Party. Well, that means some constituencies, Bristol West, for example, they may
they're
lose it. Frank Debonair, who's got one of the biggest
well
Labour majorities
this,
in the country,
the
could
week.
Lose the constituency
this
to the Greens.
Week. Yeah, so, with Jeremy Corbyn, you see, Starmer's in a bit of an awkward position. If he really does push Corbyn out, Corbyn may well join the Workers' Party and start a flood of people and other potential... I mean, Ken Livingstone apparently is kind of out of politics now, as we're about to hear. This could start a flood, which could actually loads and loads of people existing, like even you in the Labour Party, might decide, well, actually, the Workers' Party's doing rather well. I might decide I'm going to jump ship.
Well, one of the things about the Workers' Party, as they say, is they are in favour of proportional representation, as well they should be.
Which you are too.
Indeed. And if there was proportional representation, then there would be a different game. We would be playing a different game from it's more like association football rather than war game.
I don't think that works at all. I mean, a lot but we've had several guests over the last few weeks that think it's a disaster PR. But anyway, look, that aside,
well, let's have a listen to
the former Labour MP who Jeremy Corbyn kind of turned his back on, rather sadly, Chris Williamson, who was also at the Workers' Party convention on Saturday.
You know, politics is broken, isn't it, in this country? That's the problem. All the political parties, all the mainstream political parties, really represent the same thing. They're all into neoliberalism. The kind of economic agenda is neoliberal. They're all enthralled to the military-industrial complex, to the war machine. And so there'll be no difference, you know, if Labour gets in between Labour and the Tories, and there'll just be some tinkering at the edges. So there'll be no real difference. And people are crying out for change. And there's no point looking to Labour MPs to try and deliver some of that change. I mean, and Peter, you know, made the point, they're all careerists. Yeah, absolutely right, Peter, they are all careerists. And I was stunned, I was shocked, I couldn't believe it. I thought just a bricklayer from Derby, why is it falling to me to be leading the charge of some of these really important issues? But I remember saying, when we were trying to democratise the Labour Party, that being a Member of Parliament isn't a job and it ain't a career. And when you start to treat being a Member of Parliament as a job or a career, you start to make decisions based on what's good for your job and what's good for your career. That's why none of the Socialist Campaign Group came to my support, or indeed anybody else's support for that matter. You know, people like Ken Livingstone, the man who in the autumn of his life was seen as a social pariah, is now suffering with Alzheimer's and, you know, is not in a good way. For somebody who probably did more in public office to advance the cause of anti-racism than anybody else, to be ostracised as some sort of bigot, as some sort of racist, is absolutely despicable. Absolutely despicable.
So this is the former Labour MP, Chris Williamson there. The closing speeches of the Congress were much better sound quality than I got there. Have actually now been just over the last few couple of days been put up online. So I'll put links to those up on the show page at thisweek.org.uk. But it does sound to me, at least they're organised, Martin. They're getting themselves organised. George Galloway's in charge. They've got the former Syrian ambassador, Peter Ford, as one of their deputy leaders now, as well as Chris Williamson. Things are starting to, you know, build. And they've got a reasonable media operation chugging along too.
Yes, and they're absolutely entitled to pursue the path they're pursuing, because the mainstream Labour Party has gone to the right, and therefore they open up that space on their left. Unfortunately, under a first-past-the-post system, it simply leads potentially to Tory MPs, you know, skins being saved, and that's just the reality of it.
Thank you.
really should get the man himself, who's on the trumpet there, to introduce that. I'm joined by David Moat, who's a Bristol musician, also a campaigner for Palestine, particularly, amongst other things, I'm sure. David, can you just tell us a little bit about this band you're in there and some of your musical exploits?
Exploits. That's a funny word for music. The band's called Berger, which stands for Bristol European Jazz Ensemble. That's fairly old recording, 2017, I think, or 16.
2017, yeah.
Yeah, 2017. It's an attempt to bring together European jazz musicians, mainland European jazz musicians, who live in Bristol. And creating music that we love, jazz music. That era, it was very sort of North American influenced, Brazilian actually, that was a sort of a samba feel. But nowadays we're working with an Italian guitarist, Enrico Merlin, for a tour hopefully next year. But still very much the same concept, based on European jazz musicians, mainly Italians, in this current project. And what I like to do is, I'm an internationalist and I like to bring people together and to say something with the combination of people. What we build together is greater than the sum of the parts. And that's generally what I'm about with music. I try and build community through music.
Well, you've got a friend in Martin. You're a bit of an internationalist too, Martin, aren't you?
Yeah, and I like that style of jazz as well, so that's good.
Sorry about the little breaks in there. I didn't realise it was a compilation. David, could you tell us a bit about your campaign work? And because I know you've been quite a strong campaigner. What about do you have any connection with Israel? Do you have any connection with Palestine particularly?
My family connection is that my dad was a conscientious objector in the Second World War, and his regiment at the end of the war, he went through from D-Day, went right through Europe, and then they were shipped out to Palestine. So he was there in 1946, and then he had lots of stories about being there and was there in the 1980s. And so I kind of grew up with it, and then I visited for the first time in 1991, and I've been 5 times altogether, once as a human rights worker. So I feel very connected to what's happening.
Any Jewish background in your family?
Not that I know of. I just wrote on Facebook the other day, I think I've got a Jewish kneecap because I'm a klezmer player. I play klezmer Jewish music, and people say I play it with a lot of soul, and it really resonates with me. I've been doing that for 30 years. It's wonderful. It's all that's best, as I see it, in sort of Jewish relationship to the world, which is kind of vulnerable, cheeky, full of pathos, full of humour, full of drama. So I have a strong association with that kind of music.
Well, what I'd like to do is run through over the next half hour or so with you some of the news coverage and some of the also some of the analysis, the geopolitical analysis, the, I suppose, context of what's going on. I think it goes without saying that it's horrifying watching this unfolding, the absolutely obvious genocide. And I actually caught the BBC this week talking and one of their news bulletins, one of their presenters saying alleged war crimes. Now, I know from my legal training, first of all, these are war crimes. There's no need to say the word alleged. And even if there was the need to say the word alleged, actually these are taking place abroad, and it would be only really if they're taking place here in Britain that you could be sued for saying something like that. And so the BBC are bending over backwards, it seems to me, for the Israelis, but not bending over as far over backwards, due to topple over backwards, in fact, as Rupert Murdoch's empire, which seems to have financial interests. Maybe it's just energy in the Golan Heights, but they are most definitely as pro-Israel, as pro-genocide as it's possible for a private private media empire to be. But anyway, what do you make of what's the way this has unfolded over the last, it's almost exactly 2 months now?
Gosh, well, it's apocalyptic, isn't it? It's hugely distressing. I've been out there on the demonstrations and the vigils shouting for ceasefire. I've written several times to Thangam Debonair and got standard issue letters back with a sort of pseudo balance of the Hamas attack mentioned up front and the sort of hand wringing over what's happening in Gaza as if it's some kind of natural calamity. I'm shocked to the core. I'm not surprised by what's happening in Gaza. I've seen this poor sense of this thing since the very first time I was in Israel and Palestine in 1991. So I've seen this coming. Of course, you know, you can see something coming and then it happens. It's absolutely shocking. And I made a point in 2019 to make friends with people in Gaza, because I could see that they were getting very, very cut off with the sequence of wars. And I'd visited the West Bank several times. I have been to Gaza once in 1991. And so since 2019, I've made friends and connections with people in Gaza. And these, I get frequent bulletins through Messenger, through WhatsApp, of what's happening. So I've kept abreast of what's happening, raised a bit of money, a bit of humanitarian aid, through PayPal. So I'm kind of involved on a practical level, an emotional level. As an artist, I try and write about it. As a poet, I try and write about it. I particularly, if you would allow me, I'd like to read out a poem before my phone power goes. It's about to go. I read out a poem about what it feels like as a Palestinian to live under the situation. It's from Ibrahim Yagi, and he's a young journalist, and he's also a poet. So I'm going to read out this poem to really, I think, for all of us to get a vivid sense of what it feels like to be a Gazan Palestinian living in these conditions. So it's called Am I Alive? Am I alive? A home has vanished, devoid of feelings. A future has faded, devoid of feelings. A friend has departed, devoid of feelings. A world has lost its humanity, devoid of feelings. Gone, 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 lost, lost, lost. Humanity has lost its brilliance. Or perhaps its brilliance is gone as sleep has vanished. Yes, gone, as my identity has disappeared. Gone as my home and food have vanished. Gone as the word alive has faded. Alive. Are you alive? Am I alive? Or is life not even a word? Is that dream drowned in unreachable waters? Are we alive? Or has time frozen? Are we alive? Or has the world become colourless? Are we alive, or has that word Palestine, filled with passion, disappeared? Why are you alive if life isn't a word? Why are we gone? Why? Why are my friends, colleagues, and family vanishing? Or am I blind? Why are my home, memories, and university vanishing? Or am I blind? Am I bleeding, a shirt filled with blood? And this blood, it's not mine. It's my country. It's my country. Doctors, please come and see my mother, Palestine. People, please come and see my mother, Palestine. World, please come and see my mother, Palestine. Mother, wake up. Mother, please wake up. Wake up, wake up, mother. I will resist. I will hold that tree. I will hold my pen and write. I will go there and see who that killer is. Consider me a son if your kids are gone. Let me bring back your rights from those killers. But wake up. Wake up. Resist, mother. Resist, mother. I am here for you. I will be beside you. Trust me. This time, I am your real son. I have my ID. I am Palestinian. Look, mother. I am your son. Mother! 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 Your heart beats are back. Your voice is back. My mother, it will never fade. Palestine is a word etched in minds. Palestine is alive and will never die. Palestine is alive and will never die. Palestine is alive and will never die.
I'm not so sure about that. Looks like it is dying. When it comes to actually changing things, our politicians don't really seem to want to, David. Anything people can do, do you think?
Well, solidarity forever. I think we shouldn't give up, because this is what the politicians would like us to do.
Well, certainly, and shrug our shoulders. Words, yeah. And also, we were hearing last week from Andrew Neil, the Sunday Times editor who sacked the greatest photojournalist of the 20th century, many would allege. But anyway, let's have a listen to some of the actual coverage now. And we're going to hear a bit from ITN and a little bit from Al Jazeera.
Israel's war on Gaza has caused major devastation. Around 70% of buildings in the north of the Strip are in ruins. More than 17,000 Palestinians have been killed. And around 85% of Gaza's 2.3 million people have been forced to move, some from their hospital beds. Many countries, including the United States, have called on Israel to do more to protect civilians.
Israel has one of the most sophisticated militaries in the world. It is capable of neutralizing the threat posed by Hamas while minimizing harm to innocent men, women, and children. And it has an obligation to do so.
European NATO member countries such as the UK, Italy, and Germany are among those who supplied Israel with the weapons used in this war. But Israel's main military and financial backer is the United States. That's been the case since its creation, with widespread support from both Democratic and Republican administrations. The US provides Israel with military aid worth $3.8 billion every year. Much of it is used to buy state-of-the-art weapons. In the early days of the war, U.S. President Joe Biden assured Israel it would receive everything it needed for the campaign against Hamas.
The United States stands with Israel. We will not ever fail to have their back. We'll make sure that they have the help their citizens need and they can continue to defend themselves.
While international criticism is growing, Israel is showing little sign of changing its tactics or strategy. And since the beginning of the war, the U.S. has only strengthened its support. Fintan Monaghan for Inside Story.
Well, I presume that was from Al Jazeera,
yeah.
Am I correct?
Yeah.
So obviously it's a bit slightly different spin from the sort of stuff you're going to find on Sky News or the BBC.
But
it's
some pretty horrific figures about the number of innocent civilian deaths. What are your thoughts about, because there has been some rumours that the Americans have told the Israelis that this has got to be over by Christmas?
Well, I think you were saying earlier, what can we do? The pressure that it's building in international public opinion is putting the Democrat administration in the US on the spot. Biden needs Arab American votes. He needs them. And therefore, he's got to sit. I mean, so we had Lloyd Austin, I think it was, this morning, saying, well, we're not happy, they're killing too many civilians. Now, of course, that's not what they're saying in Ukraine, as we said earlier. They're saying that Putin has got to go to the International Criminal Court, and that it's a slam dunk, war crimes, etc., etc. Although, in actual fact, in the Ukraine case, the Bucha massacre, for example, looks as if it's been carried out by the Ukrainian SBU. But we won't go there, because that's a diversion. But I think they are, the Israeli right, who are in charge of the policy, are determined to kill as many Palestinians as possible, drive them out and all the rest of it. But in actual fact, Western public opinion, however it's been, chloroformed over the years, just simply won't accept this. And, of course, opinion in the rest of the world is absolutely horrified. You know, South Africa have already sent home the Israeli ambassador, etc. That's what's happening. Lots of Latin American countries just kicked the Israeli ambassador out. And I think Keir Starmer in this country, if he thinks it's a vote winner to be seen to be supporting this stuff, he's a fool.
Well, it's part of that Al Jazeera Inside Story from yesterday evening. Fantastic analysis from Guess Where. And this is what amazes me and annoys me, really, about the British media, is that this guy is actually from the University of Bath. He's a defence and security analyst at the University of Bath. His name's Patrick Berry.
Well, yeah, Mosul was a direct comparison because in the first week of the Israeli response, they dropped more bombs, I think it was 6,000, than the US and its coalition partners dropped against ISIL in the Battle of Mosul in a month. So that's comparatively, you know, how it adds up to something recent as 6 years ago. Look, in terms of warfare, what we're seeing is becoming more urbanized. There's more cities. They're more densely populated, and armies are actually smaller. And so warfare and the advantage to the defender means it coalesces in these areas, which makes it very, very destructive. We've seen Aleppo destroyed, Mosul destroyed, Sirte destroyed. We've seen, as I mentioned, Mariupol and Bakhmut. So it's happening in a broader trend of more urbanized warfare. And I think, and unfortunately for all those stuck in Gaza, it's a particularly, as I mentioned, densely populated, densely urbanized, and therefore more lethal environment. And as I mentioned again, this concept of proportionality, which is obviously, you know, for example, I served in Afghanistan in the British Army, and we in 2008, we were in a fairly rough place called Sangin, where we took a lot of casualties. And halfway through the tour to stop civilian casualties, we weren't allowed to fire 81 millimeter mortars anymore. Now, they're fairly small in terms of lethality. We couldn't call in 105 millimeter guns. This is at an order of magnitude way below what Israel are using at the moment, in actually a situation which is relatively similar. It was a high intensity counterinsurgency campaign. But again, as Secretary Lloyd said, you know, what we were trying to do there was separate the insurgents, the narco Taliban essentially, from the people as best we could. And the Israelis, this is completely lacking, as Colin mentioned. It's just creating a counterterrorism nightmare, I would say, for the next decade in the region and beyond. And so, you know, another course instead of standoff air power could have been, especially in this second phase after the ceasefire, could have been much more cordon sanitaire, start to gain the intelligence picture you need. You can be damn sure there's Palestinians in there who aren't fans of Hamas after this, after what's been brought on them in, you know, and not in their name, but, and start to build the intelligence picture again, and use your special forces and surveillance advantage, which you're going to need to build up again, to basically get in there and in a dirty war, degrade Hamas military wing, especially as to absolute minimum that you can.
Well, that's Bath University's excellent analysis from Patrick Berry there. Martin, I think this is particularly up your street. What he's saying is that they're creating a counterinsurgency nightmare in Gaza and beyond. So is that potentially actually the object of what the Israelis are doing?
I think it is, Tony. I think the difference between what the British are trying to do in Afghanistan, where they're trying to split the Taliban from the population, classic counterinsurgency tactics, is that the Israeli right wing wants the Palestinians dead. And don't forget, Hamas was elected in 2006, and the rhetoric from the Israeli leadership is there are no innocents in Gaza. They're all, you know, Hamas. And in a sense, they may be right, actually. After this has happened, he's suggesting that some people will be not happy with Hamas and they've brought all this on us. You may find that you've got exactly the exact opposite response, that people are determined now to fight under any circumstances, whatever, and that they're never going to give in because you're really angry.
Quite familiar, having chatted with some of the IRA people about Northern Ireland. I mean, it was quite clear that the British Army's tactics were amazing, did an amazing job recruiting to the IRA, didn't they?
Bloody Sunday.
Well, that's right. I mean, obviously, you know, people like him who served in the British Army, they learn all this counterinsurgency stuff, and that, you know, you're not supposed to do silly stuff which puts the other side.
What he's really talking about there is what weapons are used. And he's talking there about mortars, 75mm mortars, 105mm, whatever they were, mortars, artillery, these sorts of things. You don't use those if you actually want to separate out your, I suppose, insurgents from your civilians. You don't use them because you're going to start killing people indiscriminately. And what he's saying is that the Israelis are doing totally the opposite. They're even talking about nuking that place, for example.
Yeah, well, I mean, the thing is, what the Israelis could have done is immediately after the initial attack, and of course there's questions marks about how much they knew about the attack and whether they let it happen. Well, let's leave that for alone for the moment. They could have just said to the Israeli, to the Gazan civilian population, get behind our lines. We will let you through. Yeah? just come out of Gaza, and then we leave Hamas stuck in Gaza in their tunnels. We'll remove the civilian population. But the civilian population, if they'd been evacuated into the state of Israel, they would be in being evacuated to the villages and towns where their grandparents used to live.
And the
obvious conclusion then is we'll have to rebuild your houses for you.
We reported last week on the death of these Lebanese journalists. It turns out that it was actually a tank that fired at the journalist's camera. A tank shell hit the car the journalists were in Lebanon. They were on top of a hill filming something else. We're now up to 75 journalists the Israelis have killed. The obvious idea here is to just stop, David, isn't it? To stop the witnesses to this, is to kill the witnesses and to send a message to all of the media headquarters around the world. Don't send any of your journalists here, otherwise they'll be killed.
Yes, it does seem journalists do seem to be targeted, particularly along with hospital workers, along with schools, along with all kinds of things. You see, I've seen this building up since 1991, but before I talk a bit about the longer view, what we can do, we can support those voices who are thinking outside the box, who are looking at what happens the day after tomorrow, alongside keeping up the efforts for calling for ceasefire in Gaza. But at some point, there is going to be no alternative to living together, to coexisting. And there are people within Israel. I heard a rabbi the other day, a rabbi who's a settler of all things, who's in the last few years, he seems to have seen some kind of light and realizes that there is no future in continued domination and oppression. This is in the West Bank, in the northern part of what they call Samaria. He's teamed up with a Palestinian, also from the West Bank, and together they formed a group called Roots. And there's an American Jewish organization called Beit Tikkun, who are supporting this, and they had a live Zoom link. So there are people who are thinking about coexistence, about the future. It has to be predicated on justice and equality of all, citizenship for all. Of course, that's anathema to most people, most Israelis nowadays. But the alternative is, what do you want? Do you have one nation successfully committing genocide against another? That's utterly untenable, and has, apart from being appalling, that nation has no future. It's like another crusader state.
You know, we were in a situation with Netanyahu that a year ago, in fact, for the last two or three years, people have been talking about, well, not just talking about, courts have been threatening to jail him. It seems that his entire political survival seems to be, as he becomes more threatened politically, so the number of Palestinians dying seems to increase.
I think what he does.
How far can that go?
Well, there's no future to it, is there? It's a complete dead end. It's a complete dead end. It's a bankrupt, and it drags the rest of humanity in with it.
Just looking at some of the figures, there's a fascinating article I'll put a link up to on our show page at thisweek.org.uk by the Financial Times on the Israel-Hamas war, they call it, not the massacre or the slaughter. It's the military briefing, the Israeli bombs raining on Gaza. What they're doing is they've done one of the heaviest bombings in history, and this includes the world wars, and just on Gaza we're talking about here. In fact, there's 10% more of Gaza, northern Gaza, has been destroyed, more than Dresden in the Second World War. So 68% of northern Gaza has been destroyed by the Israelis. Only 59%, Martin, of Dresden was destroyed by the Allied bombers in World War II.
Well, it's utterly indiscriminate, isn't it? And I was reading this morning that they're using these bunker buster bombs, which have been given them by the Americans, which are designed to drill down into cellars and they've got a delayed fuse action. But of course, the population are hiding in those cellars. Yeah. The Hamas tunnels, I understand, are much deeper than that. So in actual fact, what's quite fascinating about this is how few Hamas people they've killed, because Hamas had dug in. just as the Ukrainian army was dug in Bakhmut. Yeah, in actual fact, that Hamas militarily is still there. They've killed a lot of civilians, and of course, ultimately, they want to kill as many as possible. And as we were hearing from Chris Busby last week, they may have been using neutron weapons in previous attacks on Gaza, which is designed to cause genetic damage to the population. And the right wing in Israel are pretty clear what they want to do here. We want to kill the maximum number of people, including things like doctors, poets, whoever is, the intellectuals, if you like. On Moon of Alabama this morning, there's I've never heard of him before, is a Palestinian writer. He's died. They've killed the journalists. They're quite deliberately targeting the people they regard as, the leaders. And at the same time, just terrorizing the general population.
So I think we have to reach out. Those of us who have the luxury to have a bigger picture and aren't in an existential crisis, as are the Palestinians in Gaza, we have to reach out with those elements of Israeli society who were, after all, campaigning hard against Netanyahu in the years leading to this particular massacre.
Well, that's right, particularly this year. I mean, there's been demonstrations every weekend, haven't there, against him?
Yeah. So right now they're in shock. There's a sort of an emotional wall of support. I don't think it goes deep.
Something like 3/4 of the Israeli population actually support what's going on. There is a 25% you're talking about here, though.
They support, because what he does is he keeps prodding this existential trauma that Jewish people in general, Israelis, feel, and has been stoked up constantly. And I think it apart from what they're doing under international law and our responsibility to international law and the British responsibility, I think there's a particular Western responsibility for what's happening, because Western so-called Christendom and the values and the cultures which have given rise to it have also given rise to the anti-Semitism that's given the Zionists the strength to believe that they need their own ethno-nationalist state. That's been fueled by anti-Semitism on a historic level. So we have a huge responsibility to work with those Israelis who can see beyond that ethno-nationalist agenda and who are starting to think about coexistence. Right now, the climate's difficult, but nevertheless, you have to try. It's not a sequential thing. You can't wait for this bombing to be over.
I think one of the allies in that is people like Patrick Berry, who are ex-servicemen themselves, and are pointing out things like the Mark 82 bomb, which the Israelis are using, as a 100-metre diameter bomb. Kill zone. So when that thing hits and goes bang, if you're within 50 meters of it, you're almost certainly going to die. And that is only a small bomb. So the Israelis and the Americans are also dropping these Mark 84s as well, which are five times more powerful. So you're talking about, maybe 200 yard radius, Martin, or 200 meter diameter. This is quite clearly an indiscriminate weapon. And as he was saying earlier, there's no excuse for using these. They're quite clearly designed to kill civilians.
Well, I think that's right. And if you look at what's happened in Gaza in the last 5 weeks, more civilians have been killed than in the whole of the war in Ukraine in 2 years. That's because the war in the Ukraine has been fought relatively, proportionately. There's been big fighting in Mariupol and in Bakhmut, but in Bakhmut, most of the population had left. It's two very tough armies battling it out. But the population has disappeared by and large.
But isn't it interesting how someone like Patrick Berry, we haven't seen him on the BBC. Let's hear a bit more from him.
I think also, if this has been happening in Ukraine, and obviously terrible things have happened in Ukraine at the Russian hands in terms of Ukrainian civilians, but if this was happening in Ukraine, the Western condemnation would be much higher. And I think really you're looking at a position now where the war crimes thing should be put on the table and kept on the table. That if you cannot, that we will come after your lawyers and we will come after your targeting cells. And this should be backed by the Gulf states as well, who for, all intents and purposes are still pretty quiet. They've been helping helping with the negotiations, but the general consensus seems to be to box this problem off as best they can and get on with building their economies at the moment. So I think internationally more can be done.
So a lot of talk from the Gulf states, Martin, very little action, if any. Actually, Jordan has been the only people who have been dropping supplies into Gaza by air.
Well, don't forget the Gulf states are undemocratic oligarchies aligned previously with the West. And Saudi Arabia are very much hostile to Hamas because it's a bit Muslim Brotherhood and very chummy with the Israelis. And, of course, the people who've really been sticking their necks out are the Houthis in Yemen, who've been fighting the Saudis for years. And they are basically saying, we're going to close the Suez Canal to Israeli traffic. And, of course, you don't have to shoot many ships or attack many ships for the insurance to run through the roof, and then the Israelis can't export or import through the Red Sea.
Oh, dear. Well, that's because
this war is not just going to be in Gaza.
I mean, it seems to me that the diabolical consequences of this, that they've factored those in and they don't care.
Well, it's true that the needs of the Israeli right wing do not necessarily coincide with those of the rest of humanity. And, this isn't just about Gaza.
No, one of the unsayables.
There's been horrible things going on in Yemen for years.
One of the
nobody's really noticed.
One of the unsayables here is, are British special forces in Gaza right now? And the former Labour leader Jeremy Corbyn actually put this question directly this week to the Defence Minister Leo Doherty.
And can he assure us there are no British soldiers on the ground in Gaza?
Speaker, unsurprisingly, I don't share his assessment or his view of the context. And of course, it's clear that the Israeli objective is to defend itself against the terrorist group of Hamas.
No answer at all, which to me sounds like, yes, they are.
Well, I think it was Socialist Worker that defied a D notice some weeks ago to say that there were British special forces in Akrotiri in Cyprus ready to go into Gaza to try and rescue, because some of the hostages have got British passports, so that would be the justification for that. But I also hear from Douglas McGregor, who's ex-US Army and is, very knowledgeable, saying that when the Israeli special forces went in with US special forces and presumably possibly also British special forces, Hamas shot them to pieces. Because Hamas are actually quite good at fighting. And that's why they haven't lost that many casualties. They're well dug in. Ultimately the Israeli army got 300,000 people. But, trying to winkle out 30,000 Hamas from, well-built tunnels in modern warfare, that's really hard to do.
Well, we're sitting, aren't we, right in the middle of one of the two countries which is making sure that Israel can get away with this. And I think we've managed to prove that both the US and Britain are not democratic at all when it comes to this.
I think my conclusion I come to is who is my enemy? You know, I'm a Quaker, I'm a Christian, and Jesus was all about loving your enemy and identifying who the enemy is. And for years and years, I thought, well, my enemy, I can't really identify my enemy. But I know absolutely who it is. It's my own government. It's my own MPs, because they're going against humanitarian interests. Again, my interest is a human being, against people I care about in Gaza. My blood boils over.
Sounds to me like you're not doing the yin-yang here. You're taking sides.
Well, of course I'm taking... You take the side of those who are, Christianity is not Buddhism. We follow a disruptor of the norm who took sides with the marginalized, with the people who were weak. And the whole point about being Palestinian is that, and there are other minorities as well, you're not part of a nation state system. You haven't got your club. It's proving absolutely What a terrible thing it is to be excluded.
Now, we're going to be a little bit of swearing in our next clip. This is Hermes the Cynic on TikTok, who I rather like. He has this... I don't know. It'll be interesting to hear from you, David, if you can agree with him. He takes a fairly hard line about those that don't support the Palestinians.
I have no respect for people who haven't publicly taken a side on the Palestinian genocide. You're weak, your bloodline's weak, and you won't survive what's coming. For those of you who are still on the fence and don't know which side to take, here's a super easy trick you can use to be on the right side of history. It has a 100% success rate. You go to the demonstrations, you go to the rallies, you'll quickly figure out who the oppressor is and who the oppressed is. Go to a pro-Palestine rally and go to the front of the rally, go to the mosh pit of that rally. See who's in charge, see who organized that. And you'll quickly find out it's Jews. It's typically rabbis who've come out day after day in support of Palestine because they are so ashamed of their Israeli brothers and sisters for the genocide they're committing. Now go to an Israeli rally. Go to a pro-Israel rally. Look for the Palestinians. Look for the Gazans. You'll quickly realize there's none.
And it's the exact same reason why if you go to a Black Lives Matter rally, it's a coalition of people. It's black people, it's white people, it's brown people, it's everyone. Then if you go to a Klan rally, it's just white people. It's the same reason why slaves don't have empathy for their masters, right? It's the same reason prisoners don't have empathy for the guards. Same reason that victims of sexual assault don't have empathy for their assailants. Because oppressed people don't have empathy for their oppressors, but people who are in the oppressive group sometimes can see, hey, I think we're the baddies right now. We should probably do something to stop this. And that's why there'll always be a coalition when it's the oppressed people, and when it's the oppressors, it's just the same group. And to the people who are going to say, well, a lot of Christians support Israel, yeah, because they want Jesus to come back and send all the Israelis to hell for being Jewish and not believing in Jesus Christ, our Lord and Savior. Like they're not their friends.
Yeah, that's the heresy of Christian Zionism, which I think is completely bonkers and wrongheaded and goes against the teaching of Jesus. I see his point.
Actually, I mean, a lot of Jews, like the Naturi Carta, say actually goes against the Torah too.
Yeah. Yes, I've got no time for it. There's a guy called Stephen Sizer you might want to have in your program sometime, who's an expert on this. He's a Church of England clergyman. He's been attacked by his own establishment.
Been defrocked by the Church of England.
Well, he's not defrocked in my eyes. He's carrying on being a good human being, and the people who know him support him.
His book, I think, is called Christian Zionism, Roadmap to Armageddon.
Yeah, something like that.
But
there's a deeper point, which I think is important, which is there's a lot of dualistic thinking going on. That's, if you stand for this, therefore you can't stand for the other. And I think our minds have to be more subtle than that. I mean, for example, in the political establishment, The Labour Party under Starmer has bent over backwards to appear not to be anti-Semitic, and in the process, it's sort of stepped in the huge pit of anti-Palestinian racism. It's because their minds aren't sort of subtle enough to see. You have to look for the humanity in everything. You have to look at the justice for everyone. I think Corbyn, to my mind, he was an anti-racist. You can't single out this one strand of anti-Semitism and then you just deal so terribly with Palestinians. The racism in our culture, it's as if culturally the Western mind has to have a scapegoat, has to have something that it can lay the blame on. And right now, in practice, it's the Palestinians. The Gazan Palestinians are the one who are the sacrificial scapegoat for the sins of the West, really, and Israel absolutely part of that. But the Israeli establishment, and within Israel, there are people who are Zionists. This is where the sort of subtle mind comes in. There are people who are Zionists, that is to say, they feel they have a right to live there. They did the Aliyah thing, they went to live there, and this rabbi, he lives in one of the settlements. Some are now really supporting the Palestinians and see the necessity of a complete reinvention of the country they live in. They're not going to go away, so you have to imagine a future that isn't simply one thing or another. You have to imagine a future of coexistence on an equal footing.
We've got the Israeli army and air force dropping leaflets telling Gazan people to move. But actually, Martin, I'm sure you've come across this. There are many thousands of Israelis that have decided to get out of the country. Jews have decided, look, let's not hang around here. This is getting really crazy.
Well, Reuters pointed out that they've been dropping these leaflets telling people to move, and then they've been bombing where they've been moved to. So
the UN has said this week that there is no safe place, so the Israeli army can't tell. But let's look at the many Jews who have now decided, look, let's get out of Dodge.
That's right. Well, I mean, we had Gideon Levi. We had a clip from him last week, didn't he? He was saying, you know, Netanyahu on one hand says, come to Israel because you're not safe unless you're in Israel, but we're about to be attacked by the Iranians who are going to bomb us with a nuclear bomb. He's saying, so hang on a minute, is this a safe place for Jews to go?
One of the big political goals of Israel post-Nakba was winning the so-called demographic war. So it's... In the many times I visited Israel and Palestine, a big drive was to get the Russian Jews subsidies in the settlements, big settlement construction. A lot of these settlements were built long before there were people to fill them. And then it was the subsidies that attracted people, the comfortable life. Well, all that dream, you know, your dream home on a nice Judean hilltop, that's gone up in metaphorical flames.
It turns out it was a bribe.
Well, that's right. I mean, the economy also in Israel is in the tank. And of course, this is where the Houthis come in. They've said, the leaders of the Houthis, that if Saudi Arabia allows it, they will bring their army to fight the Israelis coming through Saudi Arabia. It won't happen because the Saudis won't do that. But they are in a position to make it impossible for Israel to use the Red Sea to export or import.
The Americans have
there's nothing they can do about
today,
it.
Today, the Americans have told Israel not to strike the Houthis in Yemen. U.S. officials have told the Biden administration is not planning to directly target the Houthis, at least for now. So maybe that's one of the reasons that things have cooled off in the Yemen a bit, is because there are some concerns that the Yemenis will just charge over and start fighting the Israelis.
The stuff I've been reading about the Houthis is that because they've been fighting the Saudis in a really horrendous battle, I mean, the Saudis have been indiscriminately bombing them for a decade, with the full support of the British, of course. British military are embedded with the Saudi military. But the Houthis are tough. They're tough fighters, as are Hamas, as are Hezbollah. You know, if you carry on fighting, look, like the Russian army now is clearly superior to any NATO force.
I wonder what you make of, David, of this thing at the Third Temple with the Al-Aqsa Mosque, because it was called Al-Aqsa Storm, wasn't it, on the 7th of October. This is obviously a bit of a hot spot.
So, yes, the thing that's really provoked Hamas and the whole Palestinian people was the outrageous way that the carefully constructed balance between temple authorities, Jordanian authority, and previous Israeli governments, the balance with kind of how the Al-Aqsa compound was managed, accessed at certain times, and that's all been since the election.
Can we just clarify that it's actually the Jordanians that manage the access to that place, and the Israelis have been putting pressure on to get the to say, well, actually, this is now part of Israel. We want to manage access to the Al-Aqsa Mosque, and this, of course, is on the same spot as the, well, they believe it's the same spot as the original Temple Mount, and there is a far right faction within the Israelis that wants to demolish the Al-Aqsa Mosque and rebuild the Solomon's Temple right there on the same spot.
That's been a fear for many decades in Palestinian society. What started off the Second Intifada, in which, you know, Hamas had a much greater role than the PLO, was Sharon's visit, was a visit on the Temple Mound, as the Jews call it, by the Al-Aqsa Mosque. That was considered an outrageous provocation, and that's what led to the Second Intifada.
Yeah, well, anyway, this week there was a demonstration of the far right called, this week, I think it was yesterday or the day before, as a demonstration of the far right to say, actually, we need to kick the Jordanians out. So let's have a listen to a short report on that.
Well, 200 Israeli ultra-nationalists will march through the old city in the Western Wall in occupied East Jerusalem. They demand an end to the control of the Al-Aqsa Mosque compound by the Waqf Authority. That's the Islamic Endowment Authority, which administers the Muslim holy site. Well, the Al-Aqsa Mosque compound is a constant point of contention in the Palestinian-Israeli conflict. Israel's encroachments intensified in 1967, resulting in the illegal occupation of the West Bank and East Jerusalem, including the Old City and Al-Aqsa Mosque. Since 1967, Jordan and Israel agreed that the Waqf, or Islamic Trust, would have control over matters inside the compound, while Israel would control external security. Non-Muslims would be allowed onto the site during visiting hours, but not allowed to pray there. Rising temple movements have been challenging the Israeli government's ban on Jews entering the compound. Well, today, Israeli forces routinely allow groups of Jewish settlers to enter the Al-Aqsa compound under police and army protection. Israel restricts Palestinian entry into the compound through several methods, including a separation wall, and permits from Israeli authorities are hard to get.
So that's a little bit of a brief description of this. Apparently not many people turned up for the demonstration. The BBC were covering it, and the reporter actually didn't say how many people had turned up. They had a permit for 200, and it looks as if the government just gave or the police in Israel said, look, please, this is not the right time to be doing this.
Well, they had permission for only 200 people. That's because the police said you can have only 200 people, because they realised that it's a potentially explosive flashpoint. I mean, to people who are not religious, the idea that people should feel more strongly about a religious building than about children being killed seems crazy. But to religious people, this is important. I mean, to Palestinian,
yeah, do you want to say something about
Palestinian
this,
Muslims, this is the centre of
their
religious belief.
There will be a lot of people
belief.
Out there saying, actually, this whole conflict just revolves around religion. That's what it's about.
No, it's not about religion. It's a settler, colonial project, but what gives it edge and commitment of the protagonists is their religious convictions. But it has traction because it's the geopolitical interests of the great powers, Britain first and America now, to have Israel there. But it's complicated. It's more than a geopolitical thing, and it's certainly more than a religious thing. For Palestinians, it's yes, there's the religious dimension, but it's also symbolically, it's the centre of their national identity.
Well, we could look, actually, Martin, I don't know if you know much about this, but in 1984, the Indian government sent in a whole load of soldiers to the Golden Temple of Amritsar, which is the holiest building in the Sikh religion, and made a massive assault on there, which was incredibly controversial at the time. This is the sort, it's almost like that's a kind of dress rehearsal for what could happen at Al-Aqsa. Mm.
Well, I think more to the point in terms of India was the sacking of the mosque that was on, supposedly, I can't remember where it was, Ayodhya.
Ayodhya,
where there was a mosque there, which had been there for hundreds of years, and the Hindu nationalists claimed that the mosque had been built over a Hindu temple, and that, of course,
the birthplace of Ram, I think.
Yeah, that's what they claimed, yeah. And of course, the thing is that it's there. I mean, the Al-Aqsa Mosque is one of the oldest buildings in Islam, and it's an incredibly beautiful old building. I mean, to destroy it would be an act of. I mean, when the Crusaders went there, they thought that it was Solomon's Temple, which is why the Templars have circular churches, because they identified the Al-Aqsa Mosque as the original temple. People didn't know about, we didn't have modern archaeology to tell them what it actually was. And of course, the other, I think,
well,
the archaeologists
read
saying
the Bible,
the Wailing
which
Wall
tells
is actually
you what
from
it
a
looked
Roman
like.
Temple.
They didn't read the Bible, which tells you what it looked like. The mosque isn't.
Well, they didn't have photographs
designed
either.
The same.
they've only got hearsay and written records, haven't they?
What would you say to people, David, that characterise this? And I mean, you could look, for example, we've just been hearing about Hindu and Muslim clashes at situations like Kashmir. A lot of this does seem to be around religion.
No, I don't think it's about religion per se. That's simplistic. That's reductionist. Humans have a religious dimension and feel particularly strongly in that field, but it's about understanding and respecting each other, and it's about having, how do I have dignity, how do I have power? Well, conventionally in patriarchal societies, I have power by being stronger than you, and ultimately by oppressing the other, and to do that I demonize the other, I enslave the other, I enslave them because they are less than human. I create, and the more I enslave them, the more I have to dehumanize them to justify that act of inhumanity to a fellow human being. And this is what's happening in Israel and Palestine. The Palestinians are being dehumanized, or there's an attempt to dehumanize them, but I don't see it. I see the Palestinians that I know and deal with as powerfully human and dignified in the awful oppression.
Well, I mean, you could also say, I mean, that before 1945, and certainly before, well, not before 1948, but certainly before 1945, everybody, for hundreds of years, everyone's lived in peace together, these various religions. And it just seemed to me as if there is an attempt to sort of hijack the faiths in order to get them to sort of smash their heads into each other, to get everyone to say, well, look, you know, it's a bit like Northern Ireland, because I lived over there during the Troubles, and a lot of the media blithely characterised it as a religious conflict. Well, it wasn't a religious conflict. Particularly the IRA were not particularly religious. They came from, well, they certainly, you know, maybe some of them did go to Catholic Church fairly regularly, but that wasn't, I don't know what you think of this, Martin, because you got to know that conflict pretty well. Was it religious or not?
Well, I think that what this is about is our personal identity and collective identity. And religion is very much part of people's collective identity, isn't it? Mm-hmm. And it's not the only thing.
But there was surely
there are other things as well, but religion is one of them.
I mean, the Republican movement was much more of a part of what the IRA were than a Catholic.
Well, it was the Irish Republican movement was founded by Protestants from Belfast. Wolfe Tone and Robert Emmet, both who died horrible deaths at the hands of the British, were Protestants from Belfast, and that's why you've got an orange band in the Irish Tricolour. But of course that doesn't necessarily mean anything on the ground now. Modern loyalists do not identify with either of those people, and they don't see themselves as nationalists. And of course what's happened there is people have learned to live with their differences. You know, they've accepted that we're not the same,
so,
and therefore we've got to meet in the middle and compromise, which of course was always the hope in with the Oslo Accords in Palestine. But if the right wing in Israel, when their backers in the US, have never been interested in reaching the hand out.
But the right wing, who are currently in power, weren't in power before, and in hopefully, please God, won't be in power in the future. They carry. In this traumatic time and this sort of fight or flight mentality they've generated, yes, there's backing, but that'll recoil on them. I don't think that'll last forever. We have to look to the time when people will live together. There is no alternative to coexisting. Well, most of the rest of us manage it.
Well, yes, but not there. And this is why the UN has been saying this week. I mean, you were the first here to use the word apocalyptic, but the UN have been saying exactly the same this week.
The anguish of a mother refusing to let go of a child she has lost. The despair of a child forced to let go of a parent she has lost. For 2 months, the people of Gaza have endured what's been described as hell on earth. Israel has slaughtered civilians on a scale rarely seen, killed and maimed more children than any other war in recent times. The UN says a child is killed every 10 minutes, making Gaza the most dangerous place on earth for children. For the UN, Gaza is now the worst single conflict in its history. And those uncovering these horrors, the eyes of the war, have paid the highest price. Journalists and their families have been targeted, making it the most lethal conflict for media workers in decades. And yet, 2 months on, Israel's war of retribution goes on unhindered.
The catastrophic situation we see unfolding in the Gaza Strip was entirely foreseeable and preventable. My humanitarian colleagues have described the situation as apocalyptic. In these circumstances, there is a heightened risk of atrocity crimes.
Its military has flattened homes, attacked refugee camps and schools, destroyed mosques and churches, besieged and bombed hospitals, all meant to be protected under international law.
Hospital by hospital has been attacked, shelled, bombed, destroyed, and emptied. And this is absolutely unprecedented. All the governments in the world, and particularly the governments in the West and in the United States, they know that Israel has this praxis of attacking healthcare, civilian healthcare, which is absolutely contrary to the Geneva Convention.
So that's another clip from Al Jazeera with the head of the UN aid agency there also calling this an apocalyptic situation. Well, I thought I'd ask one of our Islamic research friends from Global Vision 2000 about this whole idea of the apocalypse. What does the Quran, what do the hadiths in Islam say about it?
Well, there's good and bad news here. It's not the Quran. It's the source of my information is the Hadith, the prophetic sayings they've codified, and there is a book called the Book of Fitan, the Tribulations. Yeah? Trials and Tribulations. What it says clearly is the Jews will be brought back to the Holy Land. That has happened over the last, 70, 100 years, depends how far back you want to go. So that's happened, yeah? But it also then talks about, well, it also implies they'll have the upper hand. I think you've got to read into that, you know, Jewish supremacy, etc. It talks about Malhama, the Book of Fitan. Malhama implies great wars. Malhama, not one war, but, you know, ongoing big wars. that is clearly mentioned, and again, this is going to be controversial, but I'm telling you what it says. It says the Arabs will be destroyed. But it also says the Jews will be destroyed after the Imam Mahdi comes. So, and the Imam Mahdi is from the family of the prophetic family. He's a descendant. So that means he's Arab. Well, he has to be Arab, I think, despite whatever DNA changes I've made. I'm presuming he's Arab. Well, lineage-wise, he will be Arab if he's from a prophetic family. Might be mixed race, who knows. But lineage-wise, from a prophetic family. And he will overcome the hypocrites. The implication is that there are many Muslim leaders who will have to be confronted because end times implies a battle between truth and falsehood. There is no middle way. So one thing that the coming, even now, as you know, the world is dividing into two parts. Those who are anti-imperialism, anti-this, that, and the other, oppression, and those who are against that. So the world is actually happening, as we see. People are moving into two camps globally. There will not be a middle ground. So the Imam Mahdi will have to clean out the enemy within, Muslim hypocrites and colluders with global Zionism or imperialism, whatever you want to call it, or neoliberalism. And but it also says that he will, in his battles, mainly in the Holy Land, he will ally with Jesus. He will come, it mentions it very clearly in Damascus. And the two will unite forces against the Jewish messianic leader, Dajjal, the Antichrist. And then the Jews, or Zionists, whatever you want to call them, will be destroyed. That's not my view. I'm giving you, you asked me a question. That's in the book.
So that's Global Vision 2000's Moeen Yassin speaking to me from Turkey last week. David, I mean, I think you understand why it's interesting to look at what the Quran, what the Hadiths say about this, as because, I mean, whether or not these prophecies are true, they are an enormous motivating force, aren't they? Some of the, you know, what's written in these books, like the Book of Revelation, for example.
Part of how we know about ourselves and know about the nature of God comes from these books, these holy scriptures, part of it. But a lot of it comes from our experience as human beings with each other. It comes from our intuition. It comes from what arises in our hearts. It comes from our readings of nature and our understanding of ecology and cycle and regeneration. So we should not rely on the imperfect revelations written down, whether they are within the Islamic religion, and certainly not the Christian religion. I don't pay attention to the Book of the Apocalypse. I pay attention to what arises in my heart. And my belief as a Quaker is that there is that of God in everyone. And I listen quietly to the promptings in my heart. That, for me, that's an expression of the Holy Spirit. Now, a secular person might use a different language. I don't pay over attention to these big, you know, kind of big sweeping prophecies written at a certain time, often in a certain context. The Book of Apocalypse, for example, was about the anger of the writer against the Roman Empire, thinking, oh, we're going to get you back somehow. It's infantile to every age. It's infantile to project these writings onto a particular place in a particular time. It's more complicated than that.
But the point is a lot of people do believe this, and also, of course, that quotes from these books can be taken out of context. Martin, what do you...
Well, precisely, that's what I'm saying. It is taken out of context. I mean, the context belongs to the time in which it's written.
There is a whole operation behind this, particularly with Islam that we know about, Operation Cyclone. The idea was to create a new version of Islam which would inspire jihadis to basically be proxy armies for NATO. So, you know, you've got this twisting of this too, Martin, well, haven't you? Can I just let Martin come in on this? Because I think it's quite important to understand the way that these, you know, these religions are being weaponized, actually.
Well, it's certainly the case that you've got the pre-existing religious beliefs, whether Muslim, Jewish or Christian, or other beliefs that exist, like the Yazidis in the Middle East. And then you've got the geopolitical machinations of imperialist powers playing one off against another. I mean, the British Empire basically said, I mean, at one of the stages, they said, we need to have a Jewish state. This is after the Balfour Declaration, because we need a little Ulster in the Middle East to protect the Suez Canal. So that was one of the considerations. We need a little loyal Ulster to make sure that the Suez Canal always remains British, because that was what connected Britain to India, which was the major money spinner of the empire. But of course, you've got loads of Christians like Lloyd George, who was important in the creation of the Balfour Declaration and so on, who were brought up with the Old Testament as part of what they were brought up with. And it became a kind of romantic ideal. Why can't we have the Jews going back to Palestine? And of course, there were Jews already living in Palestine. And before the Balfour Declaration, there was, in fact, and in Syria, in Damascus, you've got Jews, Muslims of Sunni and Shia, and Christians all living pretty much getting along. But of course, once we've got outside powers coming in, they want to break up the Ottoman Empire, they want to create a state of Israel to protect the Suez Canal, they then manipulate all of these pre-existing religious beliefs.
If you're an atheist warmonger, you might say, well, hang on a minute, I don't believe any of this stuff, but I'm sure we can use it to get our way. I thought one of the most, maybe the things to end on here, David, I know you want to get cracking, is actually local Jewish guy who's done a lot of writing on this subject, and particularly on the subject of the plight of the Palestinians over the last decades, and that's he's down at Exeter University, that's Ilan Pappe.
Israel is not just a state, Israel is a project. It's a settler colonial project. And I do think that we are witnessing the beginning of the end of this project, because it rests on three pillars. One is material, of course. And there I agree. I mean, when you use an index that looks at sustainability of state according to their material capability, Israel is doing well. And as you mentioned in your introductory remarks, it does well mainly because of the United States. So this is a condition that can change. The second pillar is the social coherence of the settler society. And we know that this coherence is non-existent anymore. There is a bit of an optic illusion because of the Hamas operation on the 7th of October that created a sense of unity, but it's not going to cover up for the fragmentation of the society that we have seen until the 7th of October. It seems that coherence that is based on social coherence, that is based on hatred of the Arabs or the Palestinians, and doesn't have very much anything else in common is not very sustainable. And more importantly than anything else, of course, there is the legitimacy pillar. And of Israel enjoys the legitimacy of Western governments or governments in the global north. And therefore, there is a sense that it can still be sustainable because of that support of the elites. But it has lost the support of the civil societies. And this is why probably it's the only state in the world that lobbies for its existence, not for its policies, not for its better economic performance, but for its very moral justification, and it's losing that battle. Just a caveat, as an historian, I can tell you that when projects like settler colonialism are reaching their last phase, unfortunately, this can be quite a long period. It doesn't happen in one day or 2 days. And the problem is, of course, that they become more brutal and ruthless.
Well, I do wonder if the Israelis could have been any more brutal or ruthless than they have been, David.
I can't imagine it. But nevertheless, with that brutality that's being meted out on Gaza, I still have hope that one day many Israelis will see that their future in the land that they claim they love, the Israeli occupation forces aren't really demonstrating the love of the land. But nevertheless, many people in the Israeli population who claim to love the land will realize that their only future is by living alongside Palestinians as co-equal citizens with equal rights. Mazen Kunseya, who's the head of the Palestine Museum of Natural History in Bethlehem, was saying similar thing about settler colonial states. Either they wipe out the indigenous population, or they are kicked out, or they loan coexistence throughout the world. And this coexistence, I believe, is the only future.
Well, final comment is on an article in, well, it's in various, this is in the Middle East Monitor, the excellent Middle East Monitor this week. The Israel's artificial intelligence system for target selection has generated a mass assassination factory in Gaza. Israel deployed an AI system to generate kill targets, which has turned Gaza into a mass assassination factory, according to a hard-hitting investigative report published by Israeli media outlet Plus 972 magazine. The system differs significantly from previous military operations, leading to indiscriminate killings and extremely high civilian fatalities during Israel's current offensive in Gaza. The Israeli army has files on the vast majority of potential targets in Gaza, including homes, which stipulates the number of civilians who are likely to be killed in an attack on a particular target. The number is calculated and known in advance, and the army's intelligence units also know shortly before carrying out an attack roughly how many civilians will be killed. Highlighting the shocking disregard for civilian life, the report found the Israeli military command knowingly approved the killing of hundreds of Palestinian civilians in an attempt to assassinate a single top Hamas military commander. Of course, there's another aspect to this, Martin, and David, whichever of you would like to chip in, and that is, when it's AI, no one has to take responsibility. Someone presses a button, walks off in the other direction, and hundreds of Palestinians die.
That reminds me that Barack Obama, who everyone loved, was responsible for hundreds, if not thousands, of deaths through drone attacks, and put himself at some distance from those attacks.
I think what's interesting is they say that 80% of the population in Gaza has been displaced. Now, that means that all the intel that the Israelis have got about who lives where is useless to them. Yeah? In other words, what they're doing, really, is they're trying to kill as many people as possible. That's what they're doing, and they're covering it up with various mealy-mouthed excuses, which they've given the Americans. Of course we're trying to minimise civilian casualties. They're not. The Russian army in Ukraine is. They are not.
So, time for our break now. David Moat, thank you for being you.
Thank you, Tony. Coexistence,
that's
the future.
Take, how they take Christus, that's not us. Ex Maria Virgin, Gaudete, Gaudete, Gaudete Christus est natus. Ex Maria Virgin, Gaudete.
Deposades pratiae hoc quod optabamus, Carmine latitiae devoti redamus.
Gaudete, Gaudete Christus est natus. Ex Maria Virgin, Gaudete, Gaudete, Gaudete Christus est natus. Ex Maria Virgin, Gaudete.
Deus homo factus est natura mirante, mundus renovatus est per Christo regnante.
Gaudete, Gaudete Christus est natus. Ex Maria Virgin, Gaudete, Gaudete, Gaudete Christus est natus. Ex Maria Virgin, Gaudete.
Nese celis pota clause per transita, unde lux est ota salus infinita.
Gaudete, Gaudete Christus est natus. Ex Maria Virgin, Gaudete, Gaudete, Gaudete Christus est natus. Ex Maria Virgin, Gaudete.
Ego nostro cantio, salutiam illustro, benedicat Domino, salus regi nostro.
Gaudete, Gaudete Christus est natus. Ex Maria Virgin, Gaudete, Gaudete, Gaudete Christus est natus. Ex Maria Virgin, Gaudete.
Lucky alien, free real Israeli, scuppers fawn and a million daily, bonus pressure cream. Mavon Mafalestine, 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 Mafalestine. O Sneelik, Mafalestine, O Sneelik, Mafalestine. Logosi, Amarakela, Manoi, Queen. Supposed to strike it, she on F-16. Maruel Gaktir, Gavlianada, the Intifada, Gala Club, Vukis, Lingaza, Shasta, Nark, and Nor, Gunbrat, Mopas, and Far. Palestine, and Palestine, my Palestine. Hosni Alek, my Palestine. Hosni Alek, my Palestine. Tell me for you, the land of Isa, for he, Abraham, is Misha, Mohammed, Om of Rome, Scris, the Egg Sharon. Jerusalem, door disagrees, the fog, it clock, it clock is fear, tearing grab, chuck and keen, Mavron, Mafalestine. Falestine and Falestine, Mafalestine. Husni Alek, Mafalestine. Husni Alek, Falestine. Palestine and Palestine, my Palestine. Hosni Alek, my Palestine. Hosni Alek, my Palestine.
Dead or a killer, war from the Middle East, you're a hero. Your country is causing screams that never reach your ear holes. America evicted a million ground zeros.
ask ourselves, what is the dictionary definition of terrorism? The systematic use of terror, especially as a means of coercion. But what is terror? According to the dictionary I hold in my hand, terror is violent or destructive acts, such as bombing, committed by groups in order to intimidate a population or government into granting their demands. So what's a terrorist?
They're calling me a terrorist, like they don't know who the terror is. When they put it on me, I tell them this, I'm all about peace and love. Peace and love. They're calling me a terrorist, like they don't know who the terror is. Insulting my intelligence, oh how these people judge.
Seems like the ragheads and packies are worrying your dad, but your dad's favourite food is curry and kebab. It's funny but it's sad how they make your mommy hurry with her bags, rather read the sun and study all the facts. Tell me, what's the bigger threat to human society? BAE systems or homemade IEDs, remote control drones, killing off human lives, or man with homemade bomb committing suicide? I know you were terrified when you saw the towers fall. It's all terror, but some forms are more powerful. It seems nuts, how could there be such agony when more Israelis die from peanut allergies? It's like the definition didn't ever exist. I guess it's all just dependent who your nemesis is. Irrelevant how eloquent the rhetoric peddler is. They're telling fibs, now tell us who the terrorist is.
They're calling me a terrorist, like they don't know who the terror is. When they put it on me, I tell them this, I'm all about peace and love.
Peace and love.
They're calling me a terrorist, like they don't know who the terror is. Insulting my intelligence, oh how these people judge.
Lumumba was democracy, Mossadegh was democracy, Allende was democracy, hypocrisy, it bothers me. Call you terrorists if you don't want to be a colony. Refuse to bow down to a policy of robbery. It's terrorism, my lyrics. When more Vietnam vets kill themselves after the war than die in it, this is very basic. One nation in the world has over 1,000 military bases. They say it's religion when clearly it isn't. It's not just Muslims that oppose your imperialism. It's Hugo Chavez, a Muslim. Nah, I didn't think so. Is Castro a Muslim? Nah, I didn't think so. It's like the definition didn't ever exist. I guess it's all just dependent who your nemesis is. Irrelevant how eloquent the rhetoric peddler is. They're telling fibs, now tell us who the terrorist is.
They're calling me a terrorist, like they don't know who the terror is. When they put it on me, I tell them this, I'm all about peace and love.
Peace and love.
They're calling me a terrorist, like they don't know who the terror is. Insulting my intelligence, oh how these people judge.
People judge.
You think that I don't know, but I know, I know, I know. You think that we don't know, but we know. You think that I don't know, but I know, I know, I know.
You think that
we don't know, but we know.
You're a terrorist.
Yes, I am a terrorist.
What kind of terrorist?
A terrifying terrorist.
Silence! I kill you!
Hey!
quite a selection there. So that's Steel Eye Span with our first carol of the year. I think it's okay. It being the 8th of December for us to have some carols. That's Gaudé Te, which is the gorgeous voice of Maddie Pryor. And this, I think it was just... probably the one of the great voices of the 1970s, hers was, along with the woman from Fairport Convention, Sandy Denny, absolutely brilliant singers. Where are these people now? They're probably busking somewhere, because the whole industry is just designed to churn out total rubbish now. Anyone who's actually any good will get nowhere. So that's Steel Eye Span, Maddie Pryor from 1972 with Gaudé Te, followed by Al Falastine, which is a song by Sharon Shannon, all in Irish, completely ununderstandable, but beautiful song, at least to me anyway. There might be some of you out there could understand some of it. It's all about Palestine. That's just been released. And finally, we heard from Lowkey, his song Terrorist was, I think, around about 2019 that came out, and almost immediately pulled from YouTube. So there you go. You're not allowed to say things like that, not allowed to sing songs, and you're allowed to be a successful musician. Otherwise, the YouTubers will come and try and stop you being successful, stop people hearing your music. That's how those lovely Google people operate. Anyway, welcome back to Not the BCFM Politics Show, with Irish Republican Labour activist Martin Summers and me, Tony Gosling. We're going to start with COP, Martin. We had a little clip from King Charles last week, but he's disappeared off back home. Apparently there's some sort of crisis in the royal family. He doesn't really want to hang around and save the world over in Dubai. What about these comments this week? What do you make of the guy who's in charge of it, the Dubai chief, who saying that actually we don't want to go back and, you know, that we have to be quite careful that we don't reduce use of fossil fuels so much that we have to go and live in caves?
Well, I mean, you can imagine that the United Arab Emirates, being one of the world's big oil producers, are very dubious, or rather ambivalent, about the goals of COP, whatever they are.
Was it a mistake to have the COP28 there?
Well, I imagine if you are going to make this work, you're going to have to get the big oil producers to buy into it, and they are basically going through the motions of pretending to buy into it because they feel that they have to. But, of course, the remarks he made weren't for public consumption. He just made them off the cuff and somebody recorded them.
It's called the Congress of Parties, I believe, COP. It's been really going ever since 1992, that whole process. So he's Sultan Al Jaber. So you think he's just lying, do you really? He's just going along with it, playing, play-acting,
well,
like,
I mean,
a kind
what
of
happened
pantomime.
Was what happened was somebody recorded him being sceptical about the whole thing, and he was, you know, and he basically didn't realise he was being recorded. So then he spent the whole week backtracking, saying, well, I didn't really mean that,
he said a phase-out of fossil fuels would not allow sustainable development unless you want to take the world back into caves.
Well, in other words, he doesn't buy into the basic agenda of it, even though they're hosting the summit. And, of course, what that means makes people like Greta Thunberg think that the whole thing is basically a fraud and they're not serious about doing anything about it. So that's the sort of thing she would conclude from that.
OK, well, let's have a listen now to one of the speakers. I'm sorry, I couldn't track down the guy's name, from a place called Aurora in Canada, who he decided to lecture the people in Aurora about what he thought was the global agenda with net zero all the way back from 1992.
Good evening. Restructuring of Canadian mayors and municipalities under the auspices of the United Nations began in 1992. PM Mulroney signed Canada onto UN Agenda 21. Canada thus became a UN member nation state. 178 countries signed on, lured by the promise of big money to go green. By 2000, countries, including Canada, were being governed by directions of the UN, G7, G20, World Economic Forum, and World Health Organization, to name some. Every organization named is a foreign-based NGO, non-governmental organization, and every member of all these organizations is unelected. Parliamentary procedures for law changes weren't followed. In 1994, a municipal primer was issued to all local towns outlining how they were to restructure their governments. Though the municipal primer was a non-binding agreement, all towns adopted it. Our public officials, The mayor and councillors of that day were partnered with a private corporation, the Corporation of the Town of Aurora, who appointed a chief administrative officer who helped implement the global agenda instead of a local one. The International Council on Local and Environmental Issues, ICLEI, became the main source of consultation to push and fund the global agenda. We remind you that the World Economic Forum and the United Nations signed a strategic partnership framework in 2019 to jointly accelerate the implementation of the 2030 Agenda for Sustainable Development. This is the same World Economic Forum whose chairman, Klaus Schwab, famously declared, "You will own nothing and be happy." This is the same Klaus Schwab who, referring to Canadian Prime Minister Justin Trudeau, boasted, "We have penetrated more than half of his cabinet." We would ask Mayor Marakis and the councillors, why should the citizens of Aurora bow down to the intrusive dictates of an unelected foreign entity? The fact is we should not, and we will not. What, you ask, does any of this have to do with 15-minute smart cities? Absolutely everything. SMART, S for surveillance, M for monitoring, A for analysis, R for reporting, and T for technology. Technology News editor Patrick Wood, 50 years of experience and expertise on technocracy, wrote, "The 15-minute city is a cover for data collection bonanza for technocrats who design and operate them. Cities designed for maximum efficiency always reveal technocrat thinking that efficiency itself is the goal. Maximum surveillance allows for maximum control to achieve even more efficiency. At its very root, this mechanistic thinking is anti-human. The 15-minute city narrative seeks to fool you in the guise of saving the planet, keeping you safe, and delivering convenience. It's actually the gateway to digital IDs and CBDC, central bank digital currencies. CBDCs allow bankers and or governments to freeze your bank account because you happen to peacefully and lawfully protest and express your disagreement with government policy. Anyone remember the truckers' convoy in Ottawa, February 22, when the government of Canada invoked the Emergencies Act and froze the private bank accounts of law-abiding citizens? 15-minute cities are wolves in sheep's clothing. Don't believe the countless stories spewing forth from the 24/7 basis from the elitist captured mainstream media, all claiming to have your best interests at heart. We have been burned too many times. In reality, 24/7 surveillance through the Internet of Things inside your home, 5G and LED streetlights outside, monitoring and tracking and recording everything. Implementation of exclusion zones and geofencing to restrict movement and travel. Ability to control behaviors through military-directed energy technologies. Property and car ownership to be outlawed, evictions from farms and rural areas to go to gather people into cities. Digital passports being promulgated by the UN, World Economic Forum, and the World Health Organization are in the final stages of planning and implementation. They are tied to social credit score, which is determined by compliance to government directives. These passports control all access and all aspects of life. Digital currency is being implemented to end cash and monitor all your spending. Your digital currency will be turned off or on depending on your compliance score. UBI Universal Basic Income is a state-controlled allowance forcing compliance by restricting access to food, money, services, and education. All of the above will enable climate lockdowns to be implemented easily, arbitrarily, and indefinitely. The real agenda of 15-minute smart cities is to monitor and control everyone and everything. In summary, in the coming days, Council will receive an electronic info packet which will contain the text of this delegation and other items. We, the citizens of Aurora, wish to enter into a meaningful, respectful dialogue with our elected members of Council on this complex, important issue. A key framework of that dialogue is a list of questions posed to Council. Can Council explicitly guarantee that citizens will be remained free to travel, as is their right under the Charter of Rights and Freedoms? Can Council guarantee not to restrict access to essential services, medical care, bank accounts, government pensions, utilities? Most importantly, we, the citizens of Aurora, need to have the conversation with Council about exiting their non-binding agreement with the private, for-profit entity known as the Corporation of the Town of Aurora. We need to turn back the page to a simpler time when open, transparent municipal government serving its citizens and working in their best interests ruled the day. We are your equal partners on this journey. Thank you.
So that was recorded a few months ago, but it turns out it's John Sussman, S-U-S-S-M-A-N, speaking at the Aurora Council. And I'll put a link up on our show page to strongandfreecanada.org, which is where you'll find a clip to that. That was on September the 20th this year. in fact. So, Martin, he's giving a... This is the view, which is not going to be over in Dubai, isn't it? That actually, this is a kind of hijacking of many local government and national government policies by private businesses. And this is what those delegates over there don't seem to want to talk about, is the fact that this is being decided, but not by democratically elected individuals. One thing he's pointing out there, the people are deciding this over in Canada for the people of Aurora in Ontario are all unelected.
Well, let's just pick up one factual thing at the very beginning of what he was saying. I mean, the Canada did not become part of the United Nations. It became part of the United Nations when the United Nations was formed. They were one of the founding members of the United Nations in 1946, I think it was. So, you know, in that sense, that's factually inaccurate. This line that he's taking is becoming it's a recognised political line which is developing. But I think he misses the point that in actual fact, large parts of the planet are ungovernable. And the danger that we're all going to be even now, using card file indexes, people can have their benefits cut if they don't do what the government wants them to do. The technology which is being brought in to control people is a further step in the existing power that governments and corporations have to bully people around.
Well, that's right. I mean, we were hearing just now about Palestine, about how the country is being divided, the world is being divided by this issue. But there's the same exact thing going on with COP28, I think. And what annoys me more than anything is that you're just not getting these sorts of countervailing forces, those voices who are saying, well, you know, maybe we should be doing something different rather than just changing over to this these carbon credits and a kind of market solution to the climate change crisis. And there clearly is climate change going on. I mean, it seems to me the most obvious thing to do is we renationalise our transport. That's one basic thing. We could be renationalising our energy systems, services, gas and this sort of thing, so that we can actually control energy again. But we're almost in a situation, aren't we, Martin, where actually only market forces can do it now, because we've lost control of these basic infrastructure.
I think what it is the powers that be want to be the people to implement this change, because they don't want anybody else to do it, because they don't want to lose control. And that's why they're pushing, you know, they've decided that, you know, the banking system effectively collapsed in 2008, and it should all have been nationalised, as you say, but it wasn't. And now they've reinvented themselves as the people to save the planet.
So anyway, we're going to have a listen now to BBC's Question Time from last night, where we got two completely opposite points of view. One from George Monbiot, I thought he was my friend, and Peter Hitchens. So start with George putting the case for COP28, putting the case for zero carbon.
What one single outcome would the panel like to see from the COP28 annual climate conference?
Which, of course, is taking place now in Dubai. George, single outcome? Can you pick one?
Leave fossil fuels in the ground. It's so simple. So I thank you for the question. There's now been 27 of these meetings. 25 of them have been total failures. Two of them have been partial successes, 1997 and 2015. Not a single final agreement from any of those meetings has said what needs to be done, which is to leave fossil fuels in the ground. And unless we leave fossil fuels in the ground, we have absolutely no hope of preventing climate breakdown. Because it's a bit like going on a diet and saying, OK, yes, I did eat a gigantic tub of ice cream and an enormous cake, but I also ate a salad, so why aren't I losing weight? Doesn't matter how many wind turbines you put up, doesn't matter how many solar panels you put up, unless you're retiring fossil fuel infrastructure, unless you are legislating to leave coal, oil and gas where it belongs, which is in geological strata, you are going to cook the planet. It is as simple as that. And as a result of the highly effective and lethal fossil fuel lobbying, which has been a bugbear of these conferences from the very beginning, from 1992, and has now got to such a ridiculous point that the president of COP28 is in his day job the chief executive of the UAE oil and gas company ADNOC, which is currently expanding its oil production. That is what has thwarted the simple things that need to be done. And while we wait and wait, the years tick by, and we've got so few years left now. We're going to have to take drastic action if we're going to avoid what could well be Earth systems collapse. I mean, this is the most important predicament humanity has ever faced. And by design, as a result of the enormous oppressive power of the fossil fuel industry, we're flunking it.
So, John Evans.
The most important, what if it was, that man has ever faced?
Well, to him, it is. To me, it's nuclear war. Because that's far more likely to wipe us out than fossil fuels. And of course, the wars that are being fought, short of nuclear war, there's a massive gas field outside Gaza. The Israelis are fighting the war to seize that gas field, not to keep it in the ground. It could have been developed years ago by the Palestinians if there was a two-state solution. And the Palestinians could be using the proceeds from that gas production to, develop windmills and sustainable farming in Palestine. But they can't because they're not allowed to have it. The Israelis want it. That's what they're doing. And, of course, the blowing up of the Nord Stream 2 pipeline just south of Sweden, where Greta Thunberg comes from, made a massive methane leak, huge leak of methane from that. One of the worst methane leaks ever, and it's still going on. Now, where George...
That was Jake Sullivan and the Bilderbergers, and
right.
The Office of Net Assessments behind that.
Yes, indeed. So we're now fighting all over the planet over oil fields and gas fields. And George Monbiot is saying we're going to leave it in the ground. If you're going to defeat your enemies, you are going to need tanks and artillery and aircraft. And they fly on fossil fuels. And this is...
Yeah, and steel.
Yes, and steel.
Coal, coking coal
no,
to make
so in
steel.
Other words, where I recognise the kind of depth of feeling represented by what Monbiot's saying there. It's like, our civilization has taken a wrong turn. We've got to change it all. But they're missing the point that, A, we're most likely to die in a nuclear war. We're very close to nuclear war. The closest we have ever been.
That's the UN said we reported last week. Yeah.
And if there is a nuclear war, we won't be worried about global warming because there'll be nobody left to worry about global warming.
So is it a deliberate deindustrialization program?
No, I think that is also an exaggeration from the other side, which is saying what you want is to get rid of our right to drive 4x4s and all the rest of it.
No, it's our ability to fight a war.
Well, indeed. But, I mean, we shouldn't be fighting these wars in the first place.
But you should have the right to self-defense, just like the Gazans don't have the right.
Yes.
The Gazans don't have the right to the gas fields. We don't now have the right to build our own tanks. We've got to buy them from America.
No, but we shouldn't be building tanks to invade Iraq and Afghanistan.
No,
maybe
no,
it's our soldiers that need to die. They're the ones on the wrong side.
Yeah,
maybe the soldiers in British Army who are fighting in Saudi Arabia, they need to die.
You don't think that the British have got the right to build weapons?
I don't think they've got the right to build weapons other than for defending the British Isles, and that's not what they're building them for. We do not need an aircraft carrier to defend the British Isles. We need one to go to the South China Sea and start a war with the Chinese.
One of the main bits of news from COP28, which has not been reported anywhere I've seen in the mainstream press here, is that United States has joined 20 other countries in a pledge signed at COP28 in Dubai to triple nuclear energy capacity by 2050. Well, that doesn't sound to me like lots of small modular reactors, which is what the environmental movement say is going to happen. The US and 21 other countries from four continents signed a pledge at the UN Climate Summit on the 2nd of December to triple global nuclear energy capacity by 2050 from the levels recorded in 2020. The core elements of the declaration include working together to advance a goal of tripling nuclear energy capacity, inviting shareholders of international financial institutions to encourage the inclusion of nuclear energy in energy lending policies. So this is really the sort of thing it's about. This is a massive new investment in nuclear right across the planet.
Well, I think the Greens in Germany have really got to decide what they think about this, because they've been opposed to nuclear power, and it was one of the reasons that gave them some leverage within the PR system in Germany, they were able to create a new party and get leverage because they're against nuclear power.
An important part of this, she says, includes a commitment to support responsible nations, whatever that means. Is that like America? Are they a responsible Israel? In looking to explore new civil nuclear deployment under the highest standards of safety. So they're saying, actually, what we really want is many more countries to be having nuclear reactors and be producing uranium or plutonium to go into bombs and to go into nuclear power stations.
Well, quite possibly. And, of course, there's going to be no agreement in any of this because the world is at war. This is what George doesn't quite seem to grasp. The Russians and the Chinese have to be included, and the Saudis, the UAE, have to be included, unless we're going to overthrow the Saudis, because they weren't elected, you see, not elected at all, therefore not a responsible country. We need an armed struggle to get rid of them, don't we? The Houthis are having an armed struggle against them, right at this minute. Yeah? There's no realism about this, from my point of view.
No.
This is sort of green hand-wringing.
I think it's
we're on the brink of a nuclear Armageddon.
I think it's a deliberate distraction. They're saying, do this, do this, do this. What they're saying is deindustrialise so that when we have our war, you can't fight back.
No, it's not. They're not going to deindustrialise. But what's happening?
We have deindustrialised in this country. What do you mean they're not going to?
No, we've deindustrialised in this country because we financialised everything. This is exactly what they haven't done in China and Russia. And it's too late for us. In war terms, it's too late. Even if set up a nationalised arms industry tomorrow morning, they will never be able to keep
this
them,
has
to keep
put
up
us
with
right,
their enemies.
The whole of Europe pretty much has now has been put into the hands of the United States. So if you want anything sort of big, industrial standard size stuff, you've got to buy it from the Yanks.
Well, that's not what's going to happen.
Isn't that the idea?
No, the Germans have been deindustrialized. What's happened is the Germans presented with cheap Russian gas and oil, presented a potential challenge to US hegemony and to British financial hegemony. That's why the Nord Stream 2 pipeline was blown up with a massive leak of methane.
Okay, so on question time, we had Monbiot first, but he was followed shortly after by a certain Peter Hitchens.
Peter.
So much moralising, so much posturing. What do people actually think they're achieving? Anybody can look. It's called the energy dashboard. You can get it up on your computer anytime and see on a normal day in this country where the power which is lighting your home and your place of work and everything else you see, where it's coming from. And on a day when the wind isn't blowing, it's largely coming from gas. Or it's coming from imported power, which quite often comes from the Netherlands, where they still burn coal. We don't burn coal anymore because we didn't just close down our coal-fired power stations, we blew them up. We were so certain we were right to do so. At the same time, China is, even as we speak, building the equivalent of two new coal-fired power stations a week. India has a vast expansion program of coal-fired power stations. Even if George is right about his tremendous predictions of apocalypse. And I'm not saying he's wrong. I'm in no position to say he's wrong. Even if he's right, the contribution which this country is making by what it's doing to these outcomes is not merely minimal, it's non-existent. Everything that we do is completely blotted out by what much larger countries are doing to maintain their own power. Now, if you want to live in a country with net zero, if you want to live in a country where nobody can afford to heat their house, where people have incredibly expensive and largely non-functioning heat pumps inflicted on them, if you want that kind of thing to happen to you, if you want lots of people to lose their jobs because there's no energy, if you want to be cold all the time, if you want the computers which make life possible in practically every form of life to shut down every so often, then carry on believing that the demand to go for net zero, to keep it in the ground, is intelligent and thoughtful. Even if George is right, this is not an intelligent response to it.
Okay, but Peter, in terms of the question, what single outcome would the panel like to see? What single outcome would you like to see from COP?
Well, I'd love to hear someone at one of these conferences say, do you know what, perhaps we might be wrong.
Okay.
That would be the best outcome for all of us. Just somebody who said, just for once, and the BBC might do the same thing as well. I mean.
Well, I mean, I haven't really got a dog in this fight between these two. I think what we've got to do is we've got to have a plan for dealing with the situation, which includes, even if you were going to try and phase fossil fuels out, you would need to build in the fact that the vast majority of humanity still hasn't industrialized. They need to industrialize. And if they're going to do that, then they've got to be allowed to use fossil fuels. That means other people have got to use less fossil fuels, which means we've got to have an overall agreement to share the wealth of the planet. But that's nowhere in sight, because the Western financial system is dependent on stealing the wealth of the rest of the planet. One of the things they could do, if they wanted poorer countries to leave fossil fuels in the ground, and of course in Ecuador they voted to leave the oil in the ground because the indigenous people in the national park where they were going to do it didn't want it. If they're going to do that, then you've got to cancel their debts. Now, if you cancel their debts, that means the elimination of the Western financial system, and that means the elimination of the shareholders in the Western financial system. For example, the Prince of Wales, who owns plenty of shares in lots of things. He's got to lose all of that, not some of it, all of it, and then we can talk seriously about whether we're going to reduce carbon.
The Panama Papers revealed that actually King Charles has a big stake in the carbon trading system itself. He helped set it up, and he's a major controller of it and stands to profit from it.
The carbon trading system is a pseudo market. Okay, what should happen as fossil fuels become more expensive as they run out? Remember, we used to be worried that they would run out. Is that other technologies will automatically kick in because it becomes more expensive to run petrol cars than the alternative?
Isn't a large part of this wanting not to be dependent on fossil fuels to do with the fact that there's a potential world war on the horizon, and we need to be in the situation where we're not dependent on countries like Saudi Arabia for our energy? I mean, because those tankers and pipelines may get blown up, mightn't they, in that war?
Well, that's one of the reasons why we kept a coal industry until we decided we didn't want one, because obviously it does give you that. I mean, that's one of the reasons why Japan got nuclear power, because they didn't have access to coal and oil other than imported. And in actual fact, the decisions about whether to exploit coal and oil and gas are often based on military considerations. That's why pipelines are built and why they get blown up and all the rest of it. And I just don't see there's no realism in this kind of, why don't we all, you know, get together and have a big sort of meeting and decide to share out because we're at each other's throats. There is an exploitative system called capitalism. There we are, bringing the old words back in again. The Western elite and the middle classes, upper classes in the West consume far more resources than poor people in poor countries. And that's been the problem all along. If there was a better distribution of resources, then we could manage a lot of the problems in all sorts of different ways.
Well, also,
but we've got an exploitative system that doesn't allow that.
Wouldn't it help if we had decent elections in this country? One of the yesterday, Sky reported, are Russian cyber attacks targeting UK elections? Russian cyber attackers have been accused of targeting British political system ahead of next year's general election. So who's behind these attacks and how concerned should the UK be? Sky explains. That's also another piece in The Guardian on a slightly different tack. Number 10 is urged to investigate the targeting of MPs and others by Russian spies yesterday. Cyber attacks on parliamentarians, civil servants and journalists aimed at meddling in UK politics have been going on for 8 years, they say. So there's different angles on this particular story. But what they're all saying is the Russians have got the technology to actually fix British elections.
Well, all I can say is phooey. I mean, the Russians will be monitoring what we do, mostly the military aspects of what Britain does, because that's what we do to them. And, of course, I don't know if you saw this week, but an ex-Ukrainian MP who was living in Moscow and was opposed to the current regime in Moscow was assassinated outside in a park near his home. And the Ukrainians said, yes, we did that. We paid for that, folks, the assassination of foreign MPs. We did it. British Special Forces, no doubt, involved in the planning of that. The Russians may decide to retaliate. If they did, they'd be within their rights, wouldn't they? What source would a goose is source would a gander? I don't think the Russians are doing that.
When it's Russian hacking British elections, Chief Executive of Ofcom, Dame Melanie Dawes, who was appearing on the Peston Show a month or so ago, had this to say.
So one of the things we definitely will be doing is holding, particularly the big platforms where we all spend our time. So this is companies like Facebook and Instagram and TikTok and YouTube, where basically we know that's where the British public is most of the time. That's where we're spending most of our eyeball time. Making sure that where they have terms and conditions on disinformation, which they all do, that they actually stick to them.
They're policing.
And that we know a bit more about what's going on. That hasn't happened before.
And I mean, Bob, you're very worried about bad actors, Russia and China. We all are. How big do you think the risk is that, particularly on social media, the elections will be distorted by essentially really, you know, malign information being put up?
After 2014, September 2014, Putin organised a campaign of disinformation, systemic disinformation, through the Internet Research Agency up in St. Petersburg, one of Prigozhin's front organizations. And the whole point of that was to spread chaos and disinformation and disrupt the elections in the United States and elsewhere. So he was doing things like, or the Internet Research Agency was doing things like setting up pro and anti-gun groups and getting them to have demonstrations in the same day, in the same place, in the hope that that would spark violence and chaos.
And these new AI tools make even more effective.
Absolutely, because you could do these things. You could make bots much more sophisticated. You could make bots much more human-like. Mm. So it is absolutely an issue. I think it's an issue we haven't been across enough. And I think the Russians had a massive, significant march on us in 2014, 2016. Mm. We know about it now, but actually we still don't really take it in enough. And we...
So, that's Peston a few weeks ago. Now, this is actually, that was a conversation there that was kicked off by the boss of Ofcom, the chief executive, Dame Melanie Dawes, saying, oh, actually, one of the major jobs of Ofcom is to stop the Russians telling us who to vote for in our next elections because they're hacking away there.
Well, I just think this is projection. It is, in fact, the Western intelligence services who've made they've made it their business to influence elections and to influence the electorate in their own countries through all sorts of disinformation and spinning.
So, in actual fact,
that is an example of it. They're spinning a line about Russians are doing to try and control your mind.
Someone was talking about this. I can't remember who, with regards to Israel, that actually an accusation is a confession.
I think that's right. It's the West the Russians, in fact, have a relatively limited interest in trying to influence foreign public opinion. They did have RT, which I was a regular contributor on, and it's a relatively small organisation. It just tries to get some sense of their view of what's going on out there into the ether. Whereas the West spends millions, billions on trying to control the minds of the population. And that's just normal stuff. That's what Facebook spends all of its time thinking about. How do we get people to buy our stuff? And then that goes into politics. How do we get them to vote for the people we want them to vote for? And they project this onto other countries. Because other countries don't necessarily function in that way. The Russians are becoming more sophisticated.
I mean, this is a technique. It's a psychological warfare technique, isn't it?
Yeah.
To accuse your enemies of doing what you're doing. So this is the idea, is that it becomes more difficult for them to then switch people's minds around to thinking, oh, actually, it wasn't them doing it. It's the other side. It's a psychological warfare technique, a very basic one.
It is.
And it's a psychopathic one.
It is psychopathic because it's also delusionary. I mean, all the evidence...
Well, they don't necessarily believe it, but they think that the people watching the TV will believe it.
That's right. Whereas the evidence for Russian hacking of the US election was because of the emails of the Democratic National Committee were leaked. They weren't hacked. They were leaked. They were leaked to Craig Murray, which then passed them to Julian Assange and WikiLeaks. And what they showed was that the Democratic National Committee were deliberately rigging the primaries in the Democratic Party to keep Bernie Sanders out and to get Hillary Clinton in. And in actual fact, the primaries are this is the only way you can get a say in the US is you've got to win these primaries, because it's a one-party state, basically.
RFK Jr. is not going to win, is he?
No, well, he's going to stand as an independent, but all that will do is it will give the election possibly to the Republican, whoever it turns out to be, because it's first past the post, like the rubbish we have in this country. I mean, this is total projection. The Russians do have an information warfare capacity, and their main role is to kind of basically to answer back when lies are spread about them. Look at the way the Russian Ministry of Defense has approached the war in Ukraine. They don't make stuff up. They don't say anything very much, but when they do say stuff, you can take it to the bank. Yeah, and they try to get a reputation around the world. We say we killed 40 tanks. We killed 40 tanks.
Lavrov is saying,
we killed hundreds of tanks, but they didn't kill any.
Lavrov is saying there will be a Palestinian state.
That's been the position of the Russians. It's the position of the British government. It's the position of everybody apart from the Israelis.
And maybe Rishi Sunak, who, by the way, has got some financial interests over in Israel. That's for another day. Maybe next week we'll look at that. Next week is our final show before the break. But last piece this week goes to one of the best TikTokers on the planet. Her name's Morgan Marshall.
We are living in a villain's world, and they designed it perfectly. We eat the food they give us, vote for one of two people that they tell us to, and watch the movies that they show. They take our attention as soon as we reach age 5, and they never give it back. We go to school for 8 hours a day learning what they want us to. They scold us until we obey, and then they praise us when we do. They make us form a habit of waking up and spending our entire day in a building that we wouldn't choose, so that when we get older, we are willing to do the same. Following orders becomes comfortable when we spend our childhood doing what we're told. So when we're older, we hesitate to stray outside the norm. They tell us that we should do anything we can to attend a university, because if we don't, we will fail. They manipulate us into financial dependency at a young age so that we stay liable to the system. They've given us a currency that only has value because they say it does, and we receive it by working at a business that they own. Their millions become billions while the rest of us are forced to sacrifice our time for a minuscule fraction of what our work gains for them. They provide us housing, but make it costly so that we struggle to accumulate enough wealth to escape their system. Our supermarkets are full of brands that they possess, to the point that it is difficult to find ones that they don't. Our meals are either purchased from a store that they most likely own, or created with ingredients from their brands. They tamper with the food they give us and pump them with toxic and addictive chemicals. They make the most harmful foods, the cheapest and most convenient, so that it becomes an offer that we can't refuse. Over time, we become addicted in many more ways than one, and they bombard us with temptation on every billboard or commercial. When we get sick from excessive consumption of this insubstantial food, we are forced with almost no other option but to give up financial solidity for the sake of our health. We pay thousands to facilities that they own so that they can prescribe us more harmful chemicals that simply numb the symptoms. They revolve society around addictive foods that cause disease and expensive drugs that mask them so that we stay in a forever grasp of their system. We only ever consume content that they provide. Our news channels are operated by them to persuade us into two opposing perspectives so that we never share a same opinion. Why do you think it's free? They feed us shocking news headlines that provoke emotion and grab our attention away from what's really going on in the world. They've granted us with superficial idols that portray luxurious lifestyles so that we strive to be like them and associate money with happiness. They keep us focused on worldly problems that they've created to keep us zoomed in on our physical reality and detached from our Creator. If we keep our attention on what's going on around us, we will never be present and see the truth of God within us. The villain who runs the world knows the truth of our potential, and it's in their best interest to keep us distracted and willing to submit to a system that thrives on fearful compliance. Imagine if every person on this planet believed that we were created for a reason. We would unlock an unbreakable faith within ourselves and reverse the pyramid of power in which society was built. We would see past the lie that we've been living and turn to each other for help rather than depending on our corrupt leaders. Corrupt leaders who have accumulated a discreet monopoly that succeeds in circumventing the eyes of those who are unaware through the illusion of choice. The majority of us see the world as it is portrayed, diverse, coincidental, and plausible. To someone who lives day by day without taking a step back, the world kind of seems to make sense. Then we look behind the curtain and see that it really makes sense. Where there is one lie, there is many. Once we see one lie, we will find ourselves on an endless spiderweb of mass deception. The blindfold tied around us in childhood will loosen and light will be shed on our fabricated reality. Those in charge of us do not have our best interests in mind and never did. It has been a power trip from the start, and we have gone along with it since the birth of society and will continue to until we see a reason for change and stop pointing fingers at each other.
Never a truer word spoken than by Morgan Marshall, in my view. Absolutely amazing person, woman. But yeah, she comes out with some great stuff. And also, of course, she's not blighted by those hideous algorithms at places like YouTube, right, which is just appalling. You try searching for anything of mine on YouTube, and it will just throw up any old rubbish, even if you put the right search terms in quite often, almost nothing. So that's how these weasels, the evil ones, have decided, well, we're going to take over there. Everyone will start using YouTube. Then we can just... This basically big turnaround happened around about 2016, 2017, after I had a video which went viral and got... It was a 20-minute video about Brexit, what the BBC won't tell you about Brexit, which got 1.7 million... hits over the space of just a few weeks, and that was looking at the European Union as a project of the Fourth Reich. And I got that information from a chap called Harry Beckhoff, who was a Conservative Party member, lived in Marlborough, but he was, more importantly, he was working for MI6 at the end of the Second World War, and over in North Africa, and then he was doing denazification work for MI6 in the late 1940s in Germany, and finding that they had friends in the British Parliament. They were trying to overturn his decisions to get the Nazis out of German politics in the late 1940s. Time to sign off now. Thanks to our guest, Irish Republican Labour activist Martin Summers. Also, of course, to David Moat, the musician, and just to say his band is on. His next gig is at Cottam Club. That is a Latin night on Friday, December the 15th. That's in a week's time. It's also Jim Blomfield. And the website to get these stuff from is called Head First. And Tagna Groove album launch is at Jam Jar Wednesday, December the 20th. That's also on Head First, and that's with Mohammed Erebar. So Head First seems to be the place to go from. I've never heard of it before, but that's because I'm not cool and it's jazz and things like that. So that's info from David Moat. Also must locate and read out our poem from Patrizia Opulenza this week. Ode, the grilling of Boris Johnson, another such nonsense. Boris, in a saggy suit, scrambled to say that he was sorry, but m'lady got in his way. Sit down, she demanded, or get out, she implored. Boris sat down, but said sorry once more. A grilling they did give him. His WhatsApp's busted too. Excuses are plenty. What a to-do. Communications amended and hung out to dry. Cummings and Hancock in a fight. Do or die. Cock-ups mentioned countless times. All 'tis true. Seems integrity was lacking without any clues. Nitpicking stretched out, and 'tis all that we saw. Boris on trial. What a terrible bore. Back at HQ, Rishi's sinking real fast. A nail in the coffin, an exodus en masse. From a cabinet a-rotting, up its Khyber Pass. Watch as rats jump off ships. The plan is to spoil the country we love as this coup takes its toil. Traitor's gate a-quiver, a.k.a. number 10, a cesspit of snakes and veritable den. Lying to the public, so a coup d'etat they will not see. Pillaging our country while shaking the tree. All there now is fighting, egos and twits, bashing it out with the pitting of wits. And we'll have something to say next week about this inquiry, which is really looking at, thank you, Patrizia, looking at the Inquiries Act and why that's not a proper inquiry. Final show before our break over Christmas and New Year next Friday. Do please join us. That is for the not the BCFM politics show next Friday. And do please send me interviews and story tips via the not the BCFM politics show page, where you'll find the podcast, full length interview, story tips, comment page, and our email addresses at thisweekoneword.org.uk. Do have a relaxing and enjoyable weekend, and join us for not the BCFM politics show live stream next Friday at 5. God bless, and don't let the satanic banksters get you down.
All around my hat I will wear the green willow, and all around my hat for a 12-month and a day. And if anyone should ask me the reason why I'm wearing it, it It's all for my true love, who's far, far away.
Your company. She showed me a shirt of this softer silk, well wrought with pearls about the band. Sighed, if you will be my lover so true, this goodly gift you shall command. Alison Grace, she must be the ugliest witch in the North Country. Alison Grace, she must be the ugliest witch in the North Country.
She's turned me into an ugly one.